Chapter 9. Graceling. 1. The attack was swift and vicious. The two malformed alien ships dove toward the Darmstadt and Malpert, each from a different vector. Bursts of smoke and chaff obscured the view. And then the UMC cruiser fired a trio of Kasaba howitzers. They weren't holding back. With a violent juke, one of the aliens dodged the nuclear-shaped charges. It continued past, on a collision path for the station.
No!
Nielsen cried. But the alien ship didn't ram Malpert and explode. Rather, it slowed, and with its remaining momentum, coasted into one of the station's docking ports. The long, malignant-looking ship smashed its way past clamps and airlocks, wedging itself deep into the body of the station. The vessel was big, nearly twice the size of the Wallfish. The other ship didn't manage to avoid the Kasaba howitzers. Not entirely. One of the spears of ravening death singed the ship's hull, and the vessel careened off deeper into the asteroid belt, streaming smoke from the wound burned through its flank. A group of mining ships separated from the rest of the defenders and gave chase.
Now's our chance, said Falcone. Grigorovich, get us docked, now!
What about that thing? Said Nielsen, pointing at the alien ship protruding from the edge of the station.
Not our worry, said Falcone.
The Wallfish had already cut its engines and was moving via thrusters toward the assigned airlock.
We can always blast off again if we have to, but we've got to fill our tanks back up.
Nielsen nodded, her face tight with worry.
Grigorovich, what's happening on the station?
Kira asked.
Chaos and pain, the ship mind replied.
In the hollow, a series of windows appeared, showing feeds from within Malpert. Dining halls, tunnels, open concourses. Groups of men and women clad in skin suits ran past the cameras, firing guns and blasters. Billows of chalk clogged the air. And in the pale shadows moved creatures the likes of which Kira had never imagined. Some stalked on all fours, as small and lean as whippets, but with eyes as big as her fist. Others lurched forward on malformed limbs, arms and legs that looked broken and badly healed, tentacles that kinked and hung useless, rows of pseudopods that pulsed with sickening fleshiness. Regardless of their shape, the creatures had red, raw-looking skin that oozed lymph-like fluid, and patches of black, wire-thick hair dotted their scabrous hides. The creatures carried no weapons, though more than a few had bony spikes and serrations along their forelimbs. They fought like beasts, jumping after the fleeing miners, bearing them down to the floor and tearing at their guts. Without guns, the monsters were quickly cut down, but not before they killed several dozen people.
What in God's name?
Said Vishal, his horrified tone matching Kira's own feelings. Across from her, Trigg looked green.
You're the xenobiologist, said Falcone. What's your professional opinion?
Kira hesitated.
I don't have a clue. They can't be naturally evolved. Just look at them. I don't even know if they could have built the ship they used.
So you're saying someone else made those things?
Said Nielsen. Falcone raised an eyebrow.
The jellies, maybe? Science experiment gone wrong?
But then why blame attacks on us?
Said Vishal. Kira shook her head.
I don't know. I don't know. Sorry, I haven't got the faintest idea what's going on.
I'll tell you what's going on, said Falcone. War.
He checked something on his overlays.
The captain of the Darmstadt wants to meet with you, Navarez, but it's going to take them some time to dock. They're still mopping up out there. In the meantime, let's refuel, refit, and get the folks out of the cargo hold. They're going to have to find another way to Ruslan. And I'm going to start making calls, see if I can get my hands on some antimatter, somehow.
2. Kira went with Trigg, Vishal, and Nielsen to help. It beat sitting around waiting. Her mind churned as they floated down the shaft in the center of the Wallfish. The vision she'd had from the soft blade about the staff. The being the Xeno had thought of as the Highmost hadn't looked like either a jelly or one of the malformed newcomers. Did that mean they were dealing with 3 sentient species? Hua Chong joined them on the ladder, on her way to engineering. When Nielsen asked about Sparrow,
The machine boss just grunted and said,
"She lives. She sleeps."
At the starboard hold, a babble of shouted questions met them as Trigg spun open the wheel lock and opened the door. Nielsen held up her hands and waited until there was quiet.
She said, "We have docked at Malput Station. There's been a change of plans. The Wallfish won't be able to take you to Ruslan after all."
As an angry roar began to build among the assembled refugees, she added,
90% of your ticket price will be refunded. Should be already, in fact. Check your messages."
Kira perked up. That was the first she'd heard of a refund.
"It's probably for the best,"
Trigg confided to her.
"We weren't really a welcome on Ruslan. It would have been kind of dicey getting down to land."
"That's so. I'm surprised Falcone's given out refunds. Doesn't seem like him."
The kid shrugged, and a sly little smile spread across his face.
"Yeah, well, we kept enough to top up on hydrogen. Plus, I grabbed a few things while I was on the jelly ship. Captain figures we can sell them to collectors for a whack load of bits."
Kira frowned, thinking of all the technology on the ship.
"What exactly did you—"
she started to ask, only to have a squeal of rotating metal joints cut her off. The outer wall of the cargo hold hinged open to reveal a wide jetway that joined the hold to the Malpert spaceport. Loading bots sat waiting outside, and a handful of customs officials stood anchored nearby, clipboards in hand. The refugees started to gather up their supplies and head out of the Wallfish. It was a difficult task in zero-G, and Kira found herself chasing after sleeping bags and thermal blankets to keep them from flying out of the hold. The refugees seemed wary of her, but they didn't protest her presence. Mainly, Kira suspected, because they were more focused on getting out of the Wallfish. One man did come up to her, though, a lanky, red-headed man in rumpled formal wear, and she recognized him as the guy who had jumped after the girl during the fight with the jelly.
"I didn't get the opportunity earlier," he said, "but I wanted to thank you for helping to save my niece. If not for you and Sparrow."
He shook his head. Kira dipped her head, and she felt an unexpected film of tears in her eyes.
"Just glad I could help."
He hesitated.
"If you don't mind me asking, what are you?"
"A weapon, and let's leave it at that." He held out his hand.
"Whatever the case, thank you. If you're ever on Ruslan, look us up. Hofer is the name. Felix Hofer."
They shook, and an odd lump formed in Kira's throat as she watched him return to his niece and leave. Across the hold, angry voices rang out. She saw Joris and Vera surrounded by five of the Numinists, three men, two women, who were shoving them and shouting something about the number supreme.
"Hey, knock it off,"
called Nielsen, as she kicked herself in their direction. Kira hurried toward the fight. Even as she did, one of the Numinists, a snub-nosed man with purple hair and a row of subdermal implants along his forearms, butted Joris in the face, smashing his mouth.
"Hold still,"
said Kira, snarling. She flew into the group and grabbed the purple-haired man around the torso and pinned his arms against his sides as they tumbled into a wall. The soft blade gripped the wall at her command, stopping them.
"What's going on?"
Nielsen demanded, putting herself between the Numinists and Entropists. Vera held up her hands in a placating manner.
"Just a small theological dispute," Joris finished.
He spat a gob of blood onto the deck.
"Well, not here," said Nielsen. "Keep it off the ship, all of you."
The purple-haired man wrenched against Kira's arms.
"Ah, fuck off, you hatchet face beans. And you, let me go, you walloping misbegotten graceling."
"Not until you promise to behave," said Kira.
She relished the feeling of strength the soft blade gave her. Holding the man was easy with its help.
"Behave? I'll show you behave."
The man's head snapped backwards and slammed into her nose. Blinding pain exploded in Kira's face. An involuntary cry escaped her, and she felt the man squirming in his shirt, trying to tear free.
"Stop it,"
she said, as tears flooded her eyes and blood clogged her nose and throat. The man swung his head back again. This time he caught her right in the chin. It hurt. A lot. Kira lost her grip, and the man twisted out of her arms. She grabbed him again, and he took a swing at her, sending them tumbling.
"That's enough,"
she shouted, angry. At the words, a spike shot from her chest and stabbed the man through the ribs. He stared at her with disbelief, and then he convulsed, and his eyes rolled back in his skull. Blots of red spread across his shirt. Across the hold, the four other Numinists cried out. Horror immediately replaced Kira's anger.
No! I'm sorry! I didn't mean to! I didn't—
With a slithery sensation, the spike retracted.
Here,
said Vishal. He tossed her a line from by the wall. Kira caught it without thinking, and the doctor reeled her and the Numinist in.
Hold him still,
said Vishal. He ripped open the side of the man's shirt, and with a small applicator, sprayed metafoam into the wound.
Will he?
Kira started to ask.
He'll live,
said Vishal, hands still working, but I have to get him to sick bay.
Trig, help the doctor,
said Nielsen, drifting over.
Yes, ma'am.
As for you,
said Nielsen, pointing at the rest of the Numinists,
get out of here before I throw you out.
They started to protest, and she stopped them with a glare.
We'll let you know when you can have your friend back. Now scram!
Trig took the man's feet and Vishal his head. Then they carried him off, just as Hua Chung had carried Sparrow.
3.
Kira hung by the wall, dazed. The rest of the refugees were staring at her with fear and outright hostility. But she didn't care. In her head, the unconscious Numinist was Alan, bleeding out in her arms, while the air escaped screaming through holes torn in the walls. She'd lost control, just for an instant, but she might have killed a man, same as she'd killed her teammates. This time, she couldn't put the blame on the soft blade. She'd wanted to hurt the Numinist, to hurt him until he stopped hurting her. The soft blade had only been responding to that urge.
Are you all right? Nielsen asked.
It took Kira a moment to respond.
Yeah.
You need to get that looked at.
Kira touched her face and winced. The pain was receding, but she could feel her nose was humped and crooked. She tried to push it back into place, but the soft blade had already healed it too much to move. Apparently close enough was good enough where the Xeno was concerned.
Damn it,
she murmured, feeling defeated. The nose would have to be rebroken before it could be straightened.
Why don't you wait here for now, said Nielsen. It's better that way, don't you think?
Kira nodded numbly and watched the other woman drift off to supervise the disembarking process. The entropist came over then, and Vera said,
Our apologies for causing
such a disturbance, prisoner.
The fault is ours for telling the Numinists that there are greater infinities than the set of real numbers, for some reason that offends their concept
of the number supreme.
Kira waved her hand.
It's fine. Don't worry about it.
The entropists bobbed their heads as one.
It seems,
said Joris,
that we must part ways,
said Vera.
Therefore, we wish to thank you for sharing the information about your suit with us and for giving us the opportunity to explore the jelly ship.
And we wish to give you this, said Joris.
He handed her a small, gem-like token. It was a disc of what looked like sapphire, with a fractal pattern embedded within. The sight of the fractal gave Kira a shiver of familiarity. The pattern wasn't the one from her dreams, but it was similar.
What is it?
Vera spread her hands in a gesture of benediction.
Safe passage to the mother house of our order, the Nova Energium, in orbit around Shinza. We know
you feel compelled to assist the League, and we would not dissuade you, but
should you wish otherwise,
our order will guarantee you sanctuary. The Nova Energium
is the most advanced research laboratory in settled space. Not even the finest labs on Earth are as well equipped or as well defended. If anyone can rid you of this organism,
it is the minds at the Nova Energium.
Sanctuary.
The word resonated with Kira. Touched, she pocketed the token and said,
Thank you.
I may not be able to accept your offer, but it means a lot to me. Vera and Joris slipped their hands into the opposing sleeves of their robes and clasped their forearms across their chests.
May your path always lead to knowledge, prisoner. Knowledge to freedom.
Then the entropist departed, and Kira was alone again. She didn't have long with her thoughts before the woman, Inare, and the cat with the unpronounceable name, stopped next to her. The woman was carrying a large floral pattern carpet bag. She had no other luggage. The cat was perched on her shoulders, every strand of its hair standing on end in the zero-G. The woman chuckled.
You seem to be having an interesting time of it, Ellen Kaminsky.
That's not my name, said Kira, in no mood to talk.
Of course it isn't.
Did you want something?
Why, yes, said the woman. Yes, I do. I wanted to tell you this. Eat the path, or the path will eat you, to paraphrase an old quote.
Which means?
For once, Inari appeared serious. We all saw what you can do. It seems you have a larger part to play than most in this dismal scheme of ours.
What of it? The woman cocked her head, and in her eyes Kira saw an unexpected depth, as if she'd arrived at the crest of a hill to discover a yawning chasm beyond.
Only this, and this alone. Circumstances press hard upon us. Soon all that will be left to you, or to any of us, is bare necessity. Before that happens, you must decide.
Kira frowned, almost angry. And what exactly am I supposed to decide? Inari smiled and shocked Kira by patting her on the cheek.
Who you want to be, of course. Isn't that what all of our decisions come down to? Now I really must be off. People to annoy, places to escape. Choose well, traveler. Think long. Think fast. Eat the path.
Then the woman pushed herself away from the wall and floated out of the cargo hold into the Malpert spaceport. On her back, the large maned cat continued to stare at Kira, and it uttered a mournful yowl. 4. Eat the path. The phrase wouldn't leave Kira's mind. She kept turning it over, gnawing on it as she tried to understand. Across the hold, Hua Chung shepherded a pair of loader bots that were pushing and pulling the 4 cryopods from the Valkyrie. Through the frost-encrusted windows, Kira glimpsed Orso's face, blue and deathly pale. At least she hadn't needed to eat him to survive. He and the other 3 were going to be in for a hell of a shock once the UMC thawed them out and told them what had been happening while they slept.
You're a walking disaster, Navarez, said Falcone, coming up. That's what you are.
She shrugged.
Guess so.
Here. He dug a handkerchief out of a pocket, spit on it, and without waiting for permission, started to wipe her face.
Kira flinched.
Hold still. You got blood everywhere.
She tried not to move, feeling like a kid with a dirty face.
There, said Falcone, stepping back. Better. That nose needs fixing, though. You want me to do it?
I've had some experience with broken noses. Thanks, but I think I'll ask a doctor, she said.
The soft blade already healed me, so... Falcone winced.
Gotcha.
Okay. Outside the ship, a series of exclamations went up from the refugees arrayed before the duty officers, and Kira saw people pointing at displays along the spaceport walls.
Now what?
She said. How much more bad news could there be?
Let's see, said Falcone.
Kira brought up her overlays and checked the local news. The malignant newcomers were continuing their rampage across the system. They'd already destroyed most of the jellies and been destroyed in turn themselves, but the biggest headlines concerned Ruslan. 6 of the newcomers had blasted past Vyborg Station and the rest of the planet's defenses and landed in the capital city of Mirnsk. All but one. That one ship had aimed itself at Ruslan's space elevator, the Petrovich Express. Despite the planet's orbital batteries, despite the UMC battleship, the Surfeit of Gravitas, stationed around Vyborg, despite the numerous lasers and missile batteries mounted around the crown and base of the megastructure, and despite the best design work of countless engineers and physicists, despite all of those things, the alien ship had succeeded in ramming and severing the ribbon-shaped cable of the space elevator, 3/4 of the way to the asteroid that served as a counterweight. As Kira watched, the upper part of the elevator, counterweight included, hurtled away from Ruslan at greater than escape velocity, while the lower section began to curve toward the planet, like a giant whip wrapping around a ball.
Thule,
Kira murmured. The higher parts of the cable would either break off or burn up in the atmosphere. Farther down, though, close to the ground, the collapse would be devastating. It would obliterate most of the spaceport around its anchor point, as well as a long swath of land stretching off to the east. In absolute terms, the collapse wouldn't cause that much damage, but for people close to the base, it would be an apocalyptic event. Imagining how terrified and helpless they had to be made her feel sick. Several small, spark-like flares appeared along the length of cable still attached to Ruslan.
What are those? She asked.
Transport pods, I bet, said Falcone. Most of them should be able to land safely.
Kira shivered. Riding the beanstalk had been one of the more memorable experiences she'd had with Alan during their brief shore leave prior to the launch of the Audra survey mission. The view from high on the cable had been incredible. They'd been able to see all the way to the numinous flange, far to the north.
Glad I'm not there, she said.
Amen to that.
Then Falcone gestured toward the spaceport.
Captain Akawe, the captain of the Darmstadt, is ready to see us.
Us?
Falcone gave her a clipped nod.
The liaison officer said they have some questions for me. Probably about our little excursion to the jelly ship.
Ah. It comforted Kira to know she wouldn't be facing the UMC by herself. Even if Falcone wasn't a friend, she knew she could count on him to watch her back. And she figured saving Trig and Sparrow ought to have earned her some goodwill.
All right, let's go.
After you.
Chapter 10. Darmstadt. 1. From the Wallfish airlock, Falcone led Kira into a tunnel that burrowed through the rocky asteroid that Malpert was built on and in. They'd floated halfway around the circumference of the station before Kira realized they weren't going to enter the rotating hab ring closer to the center.
Akawe wants to meet on the Darmstadt, said Falcone. I figure they think it's more secure. No monsters running around.
Kira wondered if she should be worried. Then she shrugged off the concern. It didn't matter. At least she wouldn't be in zero-G on the Darmstadt. Evidence of the fight with the newcomers was everywhere. The air smelled of smoke, the walls were scorched and pocked, and the people they passed had round, staring expressions, as if they were still in shock. The tunnel passed through a large dome, half of which was closed off behind doors that said Eichen Manufacturing. In front of the doors, Kira saw what remained of one of the unidentified aliens. The creature had been torn and splattered by bullets, but she could still make out its basic shape. Unlike the others, this one had black shards across its back, bone or shell, it was hard to tell. Double-jointed legs, three of them, if she was counting correctly. Long, carnivorous jaw. Was that a second jaw near the prominence of the chest? Kira moved closer, wishing she had a chip lab, a scalpel, and a couple of uninterrupted hours to study the specimen. Falcone's hand on her shoulder stopped her. We don't want to keep Akawe waiting. Bad idea.
Yeah.
Kira turned away from the corpse. All she wanted to do was her job, and the universe kept conspiring to prevent it. Fighting wasn't her thing. She wanted to learn. So then why had she stabbed the Numinist? Rat bastard though he was, the man hadn't deserved a blade to the chest. A pair of marines in heavy power armor was waiting for them outside the airlock to the Darmstadt.
No weapons allowed, said the near marine, holding up a hand.
Falcone grimaced but unbuckled his belt and handed it and his pistol to the marine without protest. The pressure door rolled open.
Ensign Merrick will show you the way, said the marine.
Merrick, a thin, stressed-looking man with a smear of grease on his chin and a bloody bandage taped to his forehead, was waiting for them inside.
After me,
he said, leading them deeper into the UMC cruiser. The layout of the Darmstadt was identical to that of the extenuating circumstances. It gave Kira uncomfortable flashbacks of running through corridors while listening to the sounds of alarms and gunfire. Once they passed through the hub of the ship and transitioned to the rotating hab spokes, they were again able to walk normally, which Kira welcomed. Ushering them into a small meeting room with a table in the middle, Merrick said,
Captain Akawe will be with you directly.
Then he left, closing the pressure door behind him. Kira remained standing, as did Falcone. He seemed as conscious as she was that the UMC had them under surveillance, They didn't have to wait long before the door slammed open and four men filed in. Two Marines, who remained standing by the entrance, and two officers. The captain was easy to identify by the bars on his uniform. Of medium height, with dark skin and a 5 o'clock shadow, he had the overstimmed look of someone who hadn't got a proper sleep for several days. There was something about his face that struck Kira as being too symmetrical, too perfect, as if she were looking at a mannequin brought to life. It took her a moment to realize the captain's body was a construct. The other officer looked to be the second in command. He was lean, with a heavy jaw and creases like scars along his hollow cheeks. His short-cut hair was receding, and his eyes glowed with the deep, predatory yellow of a tiger moll's. Kira had heard stories about soldiers who chose to have the gene hack so they could see better during combat, but she'd never met anyone with the mod. Akawe went around the table and sat at the single chair on that side. He motioned. Sit. His second in command remained standing by his side, back regulation straight. Kira and Falcone obeyed. The chairs were hard and uncomfortable, devoid of padding. Akawe crossed his arms and eyed them with something akin to disgust. God damn. What a sorry-looking pair you are. Wouldn't you agree, First Officer Koyich?
Sir, yes I would, sir, replied the yellow-eyed man.
The captain nodded. Damn right.
Let me be clear here, Mr. Falcone, and Ms. whatever your name is. I don't have time to waste on you. There's an honest-to-God alien invasion going on. I've got a damaged ship that needs attending to, and for some reason Commander's chewing on my ass to get everyone from the Valkyrie ship back to Vyborg yesterday. They're pissed that you decided to change course and head for Malput instead of Ruslan. If that weren't enough, you kicked up a real hornet's nest by boarding that jelly ship. I don't know what kind of bullshit you're trying to pull, but you have exactly 30 seconds to convince me you have anything worth saying.
I can understand the jelly's language, said Kira.
Akawe blinked, twice, and then said, Somehow I doubt that. 25 seconds and counting. She lifted her chin.
My name is Kira Nevarez, and I was the lead xenobiologist on the team sent to survey the planet Adrastea at Sigma Draconis. 4 months ago, we discovered an alien artifact on Adrastea, which led to the destruction of the UMCS extenuating circumstances.
Akawe and Koyich exchanged glances. Then the captain uncrossed his arms and leaned forward. He templed his fingers under his chin.
Okay, Ms. Nevarez. You now have my undivided attention. Enlighten me.
I need to show you something first.
She raised a hand, held it palm up.
You have to promise not to overreact.
Akawe snorted.
I seriously doubt there is anything.
He stopped as a cluster of spikes emerged from her hand. Behind her, Kira heard the Marines lift their weapons, and she knew they were aiming at her head.
It's safe, she said, straining to hold the spikes in place. Mostly.
She relaxed and allowed her palm to smooth over. Then she started to tell her story. 2. Kira lied. Not about everything, but, as with the crew of the Wallfish, she lied about how her friends and teammates had died on Adra, blamed it on the jellies. It was stupid of her. If Akawe thawed out Orso or his companions and debriefed them, her lies would become obvious. But Kira couldn't help herself. Admitting her role in the deaths, especially Alan's, was more than she could bear to face at the moment. If nothing else, she feared it would confirm Falcone's worst impression of her. Aside from that, she told the truth as best she understood it, up to and including her discovery regarding the staff of Blue. She also gave them Vishal's test results, all of the recordings she'd made with her contacts while on the jelly ship, and her transcriptions of the Xeno's memories. When she finished, there was a long, long silence, and she could see the eyes of both Akawe and Koyich darting back and forth as they messaged each other.
What do you have to say about all this, Falcone? Asked Akawe.
Falcone made a wry expression.
Everything she told you about her time on the Wallfish checks out. I just add that Kira saved the lives of two of my crew today, for whatever that's worth. You can check our records if you want.
He didn't mention anything about her stabbing the Numinist, and for that, Kira was grateful.
Oh, we will, said Akawe.
You can bet your ass.
His eyes blanked.
1 minute.
There was another uncomfortable pause, and then the UMC captain shook his head.
Command back at Vyborg confirms your identity, as well as the discovery of a xenoform artifact on Andrastea, but the details are classified, need to know only.
He eyed Kira.
Just to confirm, you can't tell us anything about these nightmares that just showed up.
She shook her head. No, but as I said, I'm pretty sure the jellies didn't make the suit. Some other group or species was responsible.
The nightmares.
I don't know, but if I had to guess, I'd say no.
Uh-huh. Okay, Navarez, this is way above my pay grade. It looks like the jellies and the nightmares are busy killing each other off. Once the shooting dies down, we'll get you over to Vyborg and let Command figure out what to do with you.
The captain started to stand and Kira said,
Wait, you can't.
Akawe raised an eyebrow.
Excuse me?
If you send me to Vyborg, it's just going to be a waste of time. We have to find the Staff of Blue. The jellies seem convinced that it'll win the war for them. I believe it, too. If they get the staff, that's it. We're dead. All of us.
Even if that's true, what do you expect me to do about it? Asked Akawe.
He crossed his arms.
Go after the staff, said Kira. Get it before the jellies.
What? Said Falcone, looking just as startled as the UMC guys. She kept talking.
I told you, I have a good idea of where the staff is. The jellies don't. I'm sure they're already searching for it, but if we start now, we might be able to beat them to it.
Akawe pinched the bridge of his nose, as if he had a headache.
Ma'am, I don't know how you think the military works, but...
Look, do you think there's any chance the UMC and League won't want to go after the staff?
That depends on what Fleet Intelligence makes of your claims.
Kira struggled to contain her frustration.
They can't afford to ignore the possibility that I'm right, and you know it. And that's the thing, if an expedition is going to go after the staff,
she took a breath,
then I have to go with it. They'll need me there, on the ground, to translate. No one else can do it. Shipping me off to Vyborg is a waste of time, Captain. Waiting for intelligence to vet everything I've said is a waste of time, and they can't. We need to go, and we need to go now.
Akawe stared at her for a good half minute. Then he shook his head and sucked his bottom lip against his teeth.
Damn it, Navarez.
Now you know what I've been dealing with, Falcone said. Akawe pointed a finger at him, as if about to chew him out. Then he seemed to reconsider, and folded the finger into his fist.
You may be right, Navarez, but I still have to run this up the chain of command. It's not the sort of decision I can make on my own.
Exasperated, Kira let out a sound.
Don't you see that's...
Akawe pushed back his chair, got to his feet.
I'm not going to sit here arguing with you, ma'am. We have to wait to hear what Command says, and that's the end of it.
Fine, said Kira. She leaned forward. But you tell them. You tell your superiors that if they keep me here in 61 Cygni, the whole system is going to be overrun. The jellies know where I am now. You saw how they reacted when that signal went out. The only way to stop them from getting this, she tapped her forearm, is for me to leave the system. And if the UMC sends me to Sol, that'll be another 2 weeks down the drain, and it'll just lead a lot more jellies to Earth.
There, she'd said the magic word, Earth, the semi-mythical homeworld that everyone in the UMC had sworn to protect.
It had the desired effect. Both Akawe and Koyich appeared troubled.
I'll tell them, Navarez, said the captain, but don't get your hopes up.
Then he gestured at the Marines.
Get her out of here. Put her in a spare cabin and make sure she doesn't leave.
Sir, yes, sir.
As the Marines flanked her, Kira looked at Falcone, feeling helpless. He seemed angry, frustrated by the shape of things, but she could see he wasn't going to argue with Akawe.
Sorry it worked out like this, he said.
Kira shrugged as she got to her feet.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks for everything. Give Trig my goodbyes, okay?
Will do.
Then the Marines escorted her out of the meeting room, leaving Falcone sitting alone, facing Akawe and his tiger-eyed first officer.
3.
Kira seethed as the Marines escorted her through the cruiser's interior. They deposited her in a cabin smaller than the one on the Wallfish, and when they left, the door locked behind them.
Gah!
Kira shouted. She paced the length of the room, 2.5 steps in each direction, and then dropped onto the bunk and buried her head in her arms. This was exactly what she hadn't wanted to happen. She checked her overlays. Still working, but she was locked out of the Darmstadt's network, making it impossible to see what was going on in the rest of the system or to message any of the Wallfish crew. All she could do was wait. So she did. It wasn't easy. She went over the conversation with Akawe 6 different ways, trying to figure out what else she could have said to convince him. Nothing came to mind. Then, in the stillness and quiet of the room, the full weight of the day's events began to settle upon her. Morning felt like it had been a week ago, so much had happened since. The jellies, the compulsion and her response to it. Sparrow. How was the numinous she'd stabbed? For a moment, she lingered on the thought. Then bright flashes of sensations from the fights on the jelly ship struck her, and Kira shivered, though she wasn't cold. She continued to shiver, the tremors locking her muscles into banded cords. The soft blade roiled in response, but there was nothing it could do to help, and she could feel its confusion. Teeth chattering, Kira crawled onto the bunk and wrapped the blanket around herself. She'd always done well in emergencies. It took a lot to rattle her. But the violence had been a lot, and then some. She could still feel the vomit stuck in her throat, clogging her airway.
Fool. I nearly died.
But she hadn't, and there was some comfort in the fact. Not long after, a scared-looking crewmate delivered a tray of food. Kira pulled herself out of bed long enough to fetch the tray, and then she sat with the pillow behind her and ate, slowly at first, and then with increasing speed. With each bite, she felt more normal. And when she finished, the cabin no longer seemed quite so gray or dismal. She wasn't about to give up. If the UMC wouldn't listen to her, maybe the highest-ranked league official in the system would. She wasn't sure who that would be. The governor of Ruslan? The UMC still answered to the civilian government, after all. There was also the company rep stationed on Malpert. He could arrange legal representation for her, which would help give her some leverage. As a last resort, she could always reach out to the Entropists for help. Kira reached into her pocket and pulled out the token Joris had given her. She tilted the faceted disc, admiring how light reflected off the fractal embedded in the center. No, she wasn't about to give up. She put away the token, opened a document in her overlays, and started to draft a memo outlining everything she'd learned about the Soft Blade, the jellies, and the Staff of Blue. Someone in authority had to understand the importance of her discoveries and realize they were worth taking a chance on. She'd only written a page and a half when a sharp rap sounded against the door. "Come in," she said, swinging her legs over the edge of the bed and sitting upright. The door opened and Captain Akawe entered. He was holding a cup of what smelled like coffee, and there was a stern look on his perfectly sculpted face. Behind him, an orderly and a pair of Marines remained stationed just outside the cabin.
"Seems today is a day for nasty surprises," said the captain.
He seated himself opposite her, on the cabin's sole chair.
"What now?"
Kira asked, overtaken by sudden dread. Akawe placed the cup on the shelf next to him.
"All the jellies in the system are dead."
"That's good?"
"It's fan-fucking-tastic," he said. "And it means their FTL jamming is also gone."
Understanding dawned on Kira. Maybe she could finally get a message through to her family. "You picked up news from the rest of the league." It wasn't a question. He nodded.
"Sure did, and it's not exactly cheery."
He plucked a shiny blue coin from his breast pocket, studied it a moment, and then pocketed it again.
"The nightmares didn't just hit 61 Cygni. They've been attacking all of settled space. The Premier has officially designated both them and the jellies hostis humani generis, enemies of all humans. I mean, shoot on sight, no questions asked."
"When did the nightmares first appear?"
"Not sure. We haven't heard yet from the colonies on the other side of the league, so can't say what's happening out there. The earliest reports we have are from a week ago. Here, look."
Akawe tapped a panel on the wall, and a display sprang to life. A series of clips played.
a pair of the nightmare ships crashing into a manufacturing facility in orbit around one of the moons of Saturn, a civilian transport exploding as a long, reddish missile slammed into it, ground footage from somewhere on Mars, nightmares swarming through the cramped corridors of a habdome while Marines blasted at them from behind barriers, a view out of one of the floating cities of Venus as fragments of destroyed ships rained down through the layers of cream-colored clouds, a burning fusillade that slammed into another of the broad, disc-shaped platforms a few kilometers away, destroying it. On Earth, a huge glowing crater, amid a great sprawl of buildings somewhere along a snowy coastline. Kira sucked in her breath at that. Earth. She had no great love for the place, but it was still shocking to see it attacked.
It's not just the nightmares either, said Akawe. He tapped the panel again. Now the clip showed jellies. Some fighting the nightmares, others fighting the UMC or civilians. The recordings were from throughout the League. Sol, Stewart's World, Eidolon. Kira even saw a snippet of images from what she thought might have been Shinzar. To her dismay, one of the clips appeared to have been recorded in orbit around Latham, the gas giant farthest out from Wayland. A short video of two jelly ships strafing a hydrogen processing station low in the atmosphere. Kira wasn't surprised. The war was everywhere else. Why not there? She just hoped the fighting hadn't reached Wayland's surface. At last, Akawe stopped the parade of horrors. Kira tightened in on herself. She felt raw and hurt, vulnerable. Everything in those videos was, in a way, her fault. Do you know what's happening at Wayland? He shook his head.
Just what you saw, plus a few reports of possible jelly forces on one of the moons in the system. Unconfirmed.
Not the reassurance Kira was looking for. She resolved to look up the specifics once she got access to the net again.
How bad is it overall?
She asked, her voice low.
Bad, said Akawe. We're losing. They won't break us tomorrow, and they won't break us the day after. But at this rate, it's inevitable. We're bleeding ships and troops faster than we can replace them, and there's no real protection against the sort of suicide runs the nightmares seem fond of.
Again, the glowing crater appeared on the screen.
That's not even the worst of it.
Kira braced herself.
Oh?
Akawe leaned forward, a strange, hard gleam in his eyes.
Our sister vessel, the Surfeit of Gravitas, blew up the last of the nightmares in this system exactly 25 minutes ago, just before the nightmares got blasted to Kingdom Come. Do you know what those pestilent, dick-skinned aliens did?
No.
Well, I'll tell you. They sent out a broadcast. And not just any broadcast.
An evil, humorless smile split his face. Let me play it for you. Across the speakers came a hiss of static. And then a voice sounded. A horrible, crackling voice full of sickness and madness. And with a shock, Kira realized it was speaking in English.
Die. You will all die. Flesh for the maw.
And the voice began to laugh before the recording abruptly ended.
Captain, Kira said, choosing her words with care, does the League have some sort of bioengineering program they haven't told us about?
Akawe grunted. Dozens of them. But nothing that could have created creatures like that. You should know. You're a biologist yourself.
At this point, said Kira, I'm not sure what I know anymore. Okay. So those nightmares can use our language. Maybe that's why the jellies think we're responsible for this war. Either way, those things must have been watching us, studying us.
Must have, and that makes me real uncomfortable.
Kira eyed him for a moment, evaluating. You didn't come here just to tell me the news, now did you, Captain?
No.
Akawe smoothed a wrinkle from his slacks.
What did Command say?
He looked down at his hands.
Command. Command is headed up by a woman named Shah Dabo. Rear Admiral Shah Dabo. She's in charge of Ruslan operations. Good officer, but we don't always see eye to eye. I had a talk with her. A long talk, and...
And?
Kira said, trying to be patient. Akawe noticed.
His lips twitched, and he continued more briskly. The Admiral agreed with the seriousness of the situation, which is why she forwarded all your intel to Sol in order to get guidance from Earth Central.
Earth Central? Kira hissed and threw up her hands. That's going to take what?
About 9 days to get a response, said Akawe, assuming the stiffs back home turn out a reply without delay, which would be a miracle. An actual honest-to-God miracle. A frown puckered his brow. It won't do any good, even if they're expeditious. Jellies have been jumping into this system every few days for the past month. As soon as the next batch shows up, they'll jam us again, fuck up our comms from here to Alpha Centauri. Which means we'll have to wait for a packet ship to get here from Sol before we receive our orders. And that'll take at least 18-19 days. He leaned back and picked up his cup. Until then, Admiral Darbo wants me to bring you, your suit, and those frozen marines from the extenuating circumstances back to Vyborg. Kira eyed him, trying to make sense of his motives. And you don't agree with her orders. He took a sip of coffee. Let's just say Admiral Darbo and I are experiencing a difference of opinions right now.
You're thinking about going after the staff, aren't you?
Akawe pointed at the crater still glowing in the halo. You see that? I've friends and family back at Sol. A lot of us do. He wrapped both hands around his cup. Humanity can't win a war on two fronts, Nevarez. Our backs are against the wall and there's a gun pointed at our heads. At this point, even bad choices are starting to look pretty good. If you're right about the Staff of Blue, it could mean we actually have a chance. She didn't bother hiding her exasperation.
That's what I was saying!
Yes, but your say-so isn't good enough, said Akawe. He took another sip, and she waited, sensing that he needed to talk things out for himself. If we go, we'd be disobeying orders, or at the very least, ignoring them. Leaving the field of battle is still grounds for capital punishment, if you weren't aware. Cowardice before the enemy and all that. Even if that weren't the case, you're talking about a deep space mission that would last a minimum of 6 months round trip.
I know what it would—
6 months, Akawe repeated. And who knows what would happen while we were gone. He shook his head slightly. The Darmstadt took a beating today, Nevarez. We're in no shape to go jetting off into the arse end of the Milky Way. And we're just one ship. What if we get there and there's a whole jelly fleet waiting for us? Boom. We'd lose what might be our only advantage. You. Hell, we don't even know for sure if you can understand the jelly's language. That suit of yours could be messing with your brain.
He swirled the coffee in his cup.
You have to understand the situation, Nevarez. There's a lot at stake. For me. For my crew. For the League. Even if I'd known you since the first day of boot, there's no way I can go jetting off to who knows where just on the strength of your word.
Kira crossed her arms. So then why are you here?
I need proof, Nevarez. And it needs to be something more than just your word.
I don't know how to give you that. I already told you everything I know. Do you have any computer salvage from a jelly ship? I might be able to—
Akawe was shaking his head. No, we don't. Besides, we'd still have no way to confirm what you're saying.
She rolled her eyes. What the hell do you want, then? If you don't trust me—
I don't.
If you don't trust me, what's the point of this conversation?
Akawe drew a hand across his chin while he studied her. Your implants were burned out. Is that right?
Yes.
Pity. A wire scan would resolve this right quick. Anger burbled up within her.
Well, sorry to disappoint.
He didn't seem put off. Let me ask you this. When you extend different parts of the Xeno, can you feel the extensions? Like when you rip the transmitter out of the wall? All those little tendrils. Could you feel them?
The question was so off topic it took Kira a second to answer. Yes, they feel just like my fingers or toes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Akawe surprised her then by unbuttoning the cuff of his right sleeve and rolling back the fabric. Seems I might have the solution to our standoff, Ms. Nevarez. It's worth a shot, in any case. He dug his fingernails into the underside of his bared wrist, and Kira winced as the skin peeled up in a rectangular shape. Even though she knew Akawe's body was artificial, it looked so realistic, the sight of the skin lifting was still disconcerting on a visceral level.
Wires and circuits and pieces of bare metal were visible within Akawe's arm. As he fished out a line from inside his own forearm, the captain said, "This is a direct neural uplink, same as we use in implants, which means it's analog, not digital. If the Xeno can interface with your nervous system, then it ought to be able to do the same with me." Kira took a moment to think the idea through. It seemed unlikely, but she had to concede, theoretically possible. "You realize how dangerous this could be?" Akawe held out the end of the line toward her. It looked like fiber optic, even though she knew it wasn't. "My construct has a bunch of built-in safeguards. They'll protect me if there's a surge in electricity or..." "They won't protect you if the Xeno decides to crawl into your brain." Akawe pushed the line toward her, his expression serious. "I'd rather die right now trying to stop the jellies and the nightmares than sit around doing nothing. If there's even a chance this could work." She took a deep breath. "All right. If something happens to you, though..." "You won't be held accountable. Don't worry. Just try to make this work." A glint of humor appeared in his eyes. "Trust me. I don't want to die, Ms. Nevarez. But this is a risk I'm willing to take." She reached out and closed her hand around the end of the neural link. It was warm and smooth against her palm. Shutting her eyes, Kira pushed the skin of the suit toward the end of the lead, urging it to join, to meld, to become. The fibers on her palm stirred, and then a faint shock ran up her arm. "Did you feel that?" she asked. Akawe shook his head. Kira frowned as she concentrated on her memories from the jelly ship, trying to push them through her arm, toward Akawe. "Show him," she thought, insistent. "Tell him, please." She did her best to convey a sense of urgency to the soft blade, to make it understand why this was so important. "Anything?" she said, her voice tight with strain.
"Nothing."
Kira gritted her teeth, put aside any concern for the captain's safety, and imagined her mind pouring through her arm and into Akawe's, like an unstoppable torrent of water. She exerted every gram of mental energy she had, and just when she reached her limit and was about to give up, just then, a wire seemed to snap in her head, and she felt another space, another presence touching herself. It was not so different from joining the direct feed of two sets of implants, only more chaotic. Akawe stiffened, and his mouth fell open. "Oh," he said. Again, Kira impressed her desire on the soft blade. "Show him." She reviewed her memories of the ship, including as much detail as she could, and when she finished, the captain said,
"Again. Slower."
As Kira did, sudden bursts of images interrupted her thoughts. A set of stars, the highmost standing dark against the swirling shine. A pair of crossed arms. The staff of blue. The fearsome staff of blue.
"Enough,"
Akawe gasped. Kira relaxed her grip on the neural link, and the connection between them vanished. The captain sagged backwards against the wall. The lines on his face made him appear almost normal. He fed the data cord back into his forearm and sealed the access panel.
"Well," said Kira. "That was certainly something."
Akawe pulled down his sleeve, buttoned the cuff. Then he picked up his cup and took a long drink. He made a face.
"God damn. I love my coffee, Nevarez. But it's never tasted right since I got stuck in this construct."
"Is that so?"
"Indeed it is. Losing your body isn't like getting a paper cut. No, sir. It happened to me, 14 years ago now. Back during a nasty little skirmish with the Ponder Union at the Ceres shipyards. You know why they call it the Ponder Union?"
"No," said Kira, struggling to suppress her impatience. Had the soft blade knocked something loose inside his brain? Akawe smiled.
"Because they sit around all day not working, pondering the inner workings of bureaucracy and how best to twist it to their advantage. Things got pretty heated between the union and the shipyard during contract negotiations, so my unit was sent in to settle things down. Soothe the savage beast." oil on troubled waters. Peacekeeping mission, my ass. We ended up facing off with a crowd of protesters. I knew they meant trouble. But they were civilians, you see. If we'd been in a combat zone, I wouldn't have hesitated.
Post overwatch, deploy drones, secure the perimeter, force the crowd to disperse.
The whole nine yards. But I didn't. Because I was trying to avoid escalating the situation. There were kids there, for crying out loud. Akawe peered at her over the rim of his cup. The crowd got all riled up, and then they hit us with a microwave that fried our drones. The bastards had been planning on ambushing us the whole time. We started taking fire from our flanks. He shook his head. I went down in the first volley. 4 Marines ended up dead. 23 civilians and a whole lot more injured. I knew the protesters were up to no good. And if I'd just acted, if I hadn't waited, I could have saved a whole lot of lives. And I'd still be able to taste a mug of good old Joe the way it's supposed to be. Kira smoothed the wrinkles in the blanket by her knee. You're going after the staff, she said, flat. The thought was daunting. Akawe tossed back the rest of the coffee in a single gulp.
Wrong.
What? But I thought...
You've misunderstood, Nevarez. We're going.
And Akawe gave her a disconcerting grin.
This may be the worst decision I've ever made, but I'll be damned if I'm going to sit around and let a bunch of aliens wipe us out. One last thing, Nevarez. Are you absolutely sure there's nothing else we should know? Any tiny bit of relevant information that might have slipped to the back of your brain? My crew is going to be risking their lives on this. Hell, we might be risking a whole lot more than just our lives.
I can't think of anything, Kira said. But I do have a suggestion.
Why does that make me nervous? Said Akawe.
You should take the wallfish with you.
The captain fumbled and nearly dropped his cup.
Did you just seriously suggest bringing a civilian ship and crew, a group of rim runners, on a military mission to some ancient alien installation? Is that what I heard, Nevarez?
She nodded.
Yeah. You can't leave 61 Cygni undefended, so the surfeit of gravitas has to stay, and none of the mining ships here on Malpert are set up for a long-haul mission. Besides, I don't know their crews, and I wouldn't trust them.
And you trust Falcone and his people?
In a fight? Yes, with my life. As you said, you might need backup when we get to where the staff is. The Wallfish isn't a cruiser, but it can still fight.
Akawe snorted. It's a piece of dog shit, and that's what it is. It wouldn't last more than a few minutes in a shooting contest with a jelly.
Maybe, but there's one other point you haven't thought of.
Oh, really? Do share.
Kira leaned forward. Cryo doesn't work on me anymore. So you have to ask yourself, how comfortable will you be with me, with this Xeno wandering around your state-of-the-art UMC ship for months on end while you're frozen stiff?
Akawe didn't answer, but she could see the wary look in his eyes. Then she added,
don't think you can just lock me up for the duration either. I had enough of that already.
She grabbed the edge of the bunk and willed the soft blade to tighten around the frame until it crushed the composite.
Akawe stared at her for an uncomfortable length. Then he shook his head.
Even if I were inclined to agree with you, there's no way an old cargo tub like the Wallfish could keep pace with the Darmstadt.
I don't know about that, she said. Why don't you check?
The captain snorted again, but she saw his gaze shift as he focused on his overlays, and his throat moved as he sub-vocalized orders. His eyebrows climbed toward his hairline.
It seems your friends, he put particular emphasis on the word, are full of surprises.
Can the Wallfish keep up?
He inclined his head.
Close enough. I suppose smugglers have the incentive to move fast.
Kira resisted the urge to defend the Wallfish crew.
See? Not all surprises today are bad.
I wouldn't go that far.
Also,
what more can there be?
There were 2 entropists traveling on the Wallfish, Joris and Vera.
Akawe's perfectly shaped eyebrows rose.
Entropists, eh? That's quite a passenger list.
You might want to bring them along as well. If we're going to be looking at alien tech, their expertise would be useful. I can translate, but I'm no physicist or engineer.
He grunted. I'll take it under consideration.
So, is that a yes for the wallfish? The captain drained the last of his coffee and stood.
Depends. It's not as easy as you make it out to be. I'll let you know once I decide.
Then he left, and the smell of coffee lingering in the air was the only evidence of his visit. 4. Kira let out her breath. They were actually going to go after the Staff of Blue, and she was going to see the system the Soft Blade had shown her. It hardly seemed real. She wondered what the name of the old red star was. It must have one. Unable to bear sitting any longer, she hopped up and started to pace the small space of the cabin. Would Falcone agree to accompany the Darmstadt if Akawe asked? She wasn't sure, but she hoped so. Kira wanted the wallfish to go with them for all the reasons she'd given Akawe, but also for her own selfish reasons. After her experience on the extenuating circumstances, she didn't want to end up trapped on a UMC ship for months at a time, subject to constant surveillance by their doctors and their machines. Although she wouldn't be as vulnerable as before, she touched the fibers along her forearm, tracing them. Now that she could control the soft blade, some of the time at least, she could hold her own against a trooper in power armor if need be. And with the Xeno, she could easily escape a quarantine room like the one on the extenuating circumstances. The knowledge kept her from feeling helpless. An hour passed. Kira heard thuds and booms resonating through the cruiser's hull. Repairs, she guessed, or supplies being loaded. But it was hard to be sure. Then an incoming call popped up on her overlays. She accepted it and found herself looking at a video of Akawe backed by several consoles. The man looked annoyed.
Navarez, I had a friendly-like chat with Captain Falcone about your proposition. He's proving to be a real sumbitch when it comes to setting terms. We've promised him all the antimatter his ship can carry and pardons for the whole crew, but he's refusing to say yes or no until he talks with you. You willing to have a word with him?
Kira nodded. Patch him through. Akawe's face vanished, although Kira was sure he was still monitoring the line, replaced by Falcone's. As always, his eyes were two bright chips of ice.
Kira, he said.
Falcone, what's with the pardons? A hint of discomfort appeared in his expression.
I'll tell you about it later.
Captain Akawe said you want to talk?
Yeah, this crazy-ass idea of yours. Are you sure, Kira? Are you really, really sure?
His question was so similar to Akawe's earlier, Kira nearly laughed.
As sure as I can be.
Falcone tilted his head to one side.
Sure enough to risk your life on it? My life? Triggs? How about Runcible's?
At that, Kira did crack a smile, if only a tiny one.
I can't make any promises, Falcone. I'm not asking for any.
But, yeah, I think this is as important as it gets. He studied her for a moment, and then jerked his chin in a sharp nod.
Okay, that's what I needed to know.
The line went dead, and Kira closed her overlays. Maybe 10 minutes later, someone knocked on her door, and a woman's voice sounded.
Ma'am, I'm here to escort you to the wallfish.
Kira was surprised by the strength of her relief. Her gamble had paid off. She opened the door to see a short, startled woman, a junior officer of some kind, who said,
Right this way, ma'am.
Kira followed her back out of the Darmstadt and onto the space dock. As they left the cruiser, the two Marines in power armor stationed by the entrance joined them, following at a discreet distance. Although, as Kira reflected, it was hard for power armor to be anything close to discreet. Familiarity washed over Kira as they neared the wallfish. The cargo hold door was still open, and loader bots were streaming in and out, depositing crates of food and other supplies throughout the hold. Trigg was there, as were Nielsen and Falcone. The captain lowered the clipboard he was holding and gave her a look.
Welcome back, Navarez. Guess we're going on a jaunt because of you.
Guess so, she said.
Chapter 11. Exposure. 1. Departure from Malpert Station was a quick and hurried affair. Kira had been on plenty of expeditions where the preparation took nearly as long as the trip itself. Not so in this case. The crew moved with purpose to ready the wallfish for the journey to come, rushing through work that normally would have taken days. Captain Akawe had given orders that the Malpert Port Authority was to give them every possible help, and that sped things up also. While loader bots filled the starboard hold with supplies and, outside, pipes funneled hydrogen into the wallfish's tanks, the crew swapped empty air canisters for full, removed waste, and replenished stores of water. Kira helped as she could. Talk was limited on account of the work, but when the opportunity arose, she pulled Vishal aside where the others couldn't hear. "What happened with the Numinist?" she asked. "Is he okay?" The doctor blinked as if he'd forgotten.
"Oh, you mean Bob."
"Bob?" Somehow Kira had trouble imagining calling the purple-haired man Bob.
"Yes, yes," said Vishal. He twirled a finger by his temple. "He was crazy as a spacebird, but other than that, he was fine. A few days rest and he'll be good as new. He did not seem to mind that you stabbed him." "No?"
The doctor shook his head.
"No, it was a point of some pride with him, even though he promised to, and I quote here, Ms. Navarez, knock off her Novelstone head, end quote. I believe he meant it, too."
"I suppose I'll have to keep an eye out for him," Kira said, trying to sound as if everything were all right. But it wasn't. She could still feel the spines of the soft blade sliding into the numinous knotted flesh. She had done that. And this time she couldn't claim ignorance as with her team on Audra.
"Indeed."
Then they returned to readying the wallfish for departure. Soon afterward, so soon that it surprised Kira, Falcone was on the line to the UMC cruiser saying,
"We're just waiting on you, Darmstadt. Over."
After a moment, First Officer Koyich responded.
"Roger that, Wallfish. Alpha Team will be there shortly."
"Alpha Team?" Kira asked as Falcone ended the call. They were in the cargo hold, overseeing the last delivery of food stocks. He grimaced.
"Akawe insisted on having some of his men on board to keep an eye on things. Nothing I could do about it. We'll have to be ready in case they cause trouble."
Nielsen said, "If there's a problem, I'm sure we'll be able to deal with it." She gave Kira a hard glance, and then fixed her gaze straight ahead. Kira hoped she hadn't made an enemy of the first officer. Either way, there wasn't anything she could do about it. The situation was what it was. At least Nielsen wasn't being actively unpleasant toward her. Alpha Squad arrived a few minutes later, four Marines and Exos towing boxes of equipment wrapped in webbing. Accompanying them were loader bots carrying cryo tubes and several long, plastic crates. The lead Marine jetted over to Falcone, saluted, and said,
"Lieutenant Haas, sir. Permission to come aboard."
"Permission granted," said Falcone. He pointed.
"There's room for you in the port hold. Feel free to move whatever you need."
"Sir, yes, sir."
Then Haas motioned with one hand, and a loader bot moved to the front, pushing a pallet with a containment bottle suspended from shock-absorbing springs within a metal frame. Kira resisted the urge to leave. None of the planet-based spaceports she knew of were allowed to sell antimatter. If the magnetic bottle failed, the resulting blast would not only destroy the port, while also setting off the antimatter contained in the other parked ships, but also take out any nearby settlement, town, city, etc. Hell, Earth didn't even allow ships equipped with Markov drives to land unless they offloaded their antimatter onto one of several refueling stations in high orbit. The presence of the containment bottle seemed to make Falcone nervous as well.
"Down the hall to the ladder. My machine boss will meet you there,"
he said to the bot. He gave it a wide berth as it floated past.
"One more thing, sir," said Haas. "Sanchez, bring him up."
From the back came a Marine leading the bots that carried the long plastic crates. On the sides of the crates were printed or stenciled lines of red text, Cyrillic on top, English below. The English said, RSW-7 Molotok, and was followed by a logo of a star going nova, and the name Lutsenko Defense Industries. And bracketing both the English and the Cyrillic were the black and yellow symbols for radiation.
"A gift from Captain Akawe," said Haas. "They're local made, so they aren't UMC equipment, but they should do the trick in a pinch."
Falcone nodded, serious.
"Stash them over by the door. We'll get them to the launch tubes later."
In an undertone, Kira asked Nielsen, "Are those what I think they are?" The first officer nodded.
"Kasaba howitzers."
Kira tried to swallow, but her mouth was too dry. The missiles would be packed full of fissionable material, and fission scared her nearly as much as antimatter. It was the dirty, nasty form of nuclear energy. Shut down a fusion reactor, and the only radioactive materials left over were those that had been made radioactive by neutron bombardment. Shut down a fission reactor, and you had a deadly, possibly explosive pile of unstable elements with a half-life that meant they would stay hazardous for thousands of years. Kira hadn't even known the ship had missile launchers. She ought to have asked Falcone exactly what sort of weapons were installed on the Wallfish before they'd gone after the jelly ship. The Marines filed past, the thrusters on their suits producing small jets of vapor. Trig, who was next to the captain, stared with big eyes, and Kira could tell he was bursting with questions for the men. A few minutes later, the Entropis showed up, travel bags in hand.
"Imagine seeing you here again," said Falcone.
"Hey," said Trig. "Welcome back." The Entropis caught hold of a grip on the wall and dipped their heads as best they could. "We are most honored to be here." They looked at Kira, their eyes bright sparks beneath the hoods of their robes. "This is an opportunity for knowledge that we could not possibly decline. None of our order could." "That's all well and good," said Nielsen. "Just stop talking double. Gives me a headache." The Entropists again inclined their heads, and then Trig led them off to the cabin where they would be staying.
"You have enough cryotubes?" Kira asked.
"We do now," said Falcone.
After a flurry of final preparations, the door to the starboard hold was closed, and Grigorovich announced in his usual, demented way,
"This is your ship mind speaking. Please make sure all your belongings are safely stored in the overhead compartments. Lash yourself to the mast, me hearties. Decoupling commencing. RCS thrust impending. We're off to parts unknown to tweak the nose of fate."
Kira headed to control, slipped into one of the crash chairs, and strapped herself down. The rest of the crew was there, save Hua Chong, who was still down in engineering, and Sparrow, who was recovering in sickbay. The Entropists were in their cabin, and Alpha Squad was in the porthold, still locked into their exos. As the Wallfish's RCS thrusters gently pushed them away from Malpert, keeping its tail end pointed away from the station to avoid frying the dock with the residual radiation from the rocket's nozzle, Kira sent a text to Falcone.
"How did you convince everyone to say yes to this, Kira?"
"It took some doing, but they know what's at stake. Besides, we're getting antimatter, pardons, and a shot at finding alien tech no one else has seen before. We'd be dumb to turn this down, Falcone."
"Nielsen didn't seem too happy about it, Kira."
"That's just how she is. I'd be surprised if she were happy jetting off into the unknown, Falcone."
"What about Grigorovich, Kira?" If he'd disagreed, Kira couldn't see how Falcone would have been able to take the Wallfish anywhere. The captain's fingers started tapping the side of his leg. "He seems to believe it'll be great fun," his words. "Falcone,
don't take this the wrong way, but has Grigorovich ever gotten a psych evaluation? It's mandatory for ship mines, isn't it, Kira?"
Across the room, she saw Falcone make a subtle face.
"Yep, every 6 months-ish, real time. Once they're installed in a new ship, and then every year after that, assuming their results are stable. We were up against a deadline when we rescued Grigorovich, so it took a while before we got into dock. He'd settled down by then, enough to pass the tests."
Falcone.
"He passed?"
Kira.
"With flying colors, and every one after that."
Falcone. He gave her a sideways glance.
"I know what you're thinking, but ship mines get graded differently than you or I. Their normal is broader than ours."
Falcone. She chewed on that for a moment.
"What about a psychiatrist? Has Grigorovich seen anyone to help him with what he went through, being stranded on that moon?"
Kira.
A faint snort from Falcone. "Do you know how many psychiatrists are qualified to deal with ship mines? Not many. Most of them are in Sol, and most of them are ship mines themselves. You try analyzing a ship mine and see how far you get. They'll pick you apart and put you back together without you even realizing. It's like a 3-year-old trying to play chess with a pseudo-intelligence."
Falcone.
So you just do nothing? Kira.
I've offered to take Grigorovich in more than once, but he always refuses. Falcone. A faint rise and fall of his shoulders. The best therapy for him is being with other people and being treated like everyone else in the crew. He's a lot better than he used to be. Falcone. That wasn't as reassuring as the captain seemed to think it was.
And you're okay with him running the ship for you?
Kira. Another, sharper glance from Falcone. I run the Wallfish, thank you very much. And yes, I'm very okay with Grigorovich. He's gotten us out of more scrapes than I care to remember. And he's an important and valued member of my crew. Any other questions, Nevarez? Falcone. Kira decided it was better not to press her luck, so she gave a tiny shake of her head and switched to the view from the outside cameras. When the Wallfish was a safe distance from Malpert, the thrust alert sounded, and then the main rocket fired. Kira swallowed and let her head fall back against the chair. They were on their way. 2. The Darmstadt followed some hours behind the Wallfish. Repairs and the need to take on a rather substantial amount of food for its crew had slowed its departure. Still, the cruiser would catch up with the Wallfish by the following morning. It would take them a day and a half to reach the Markov limit. And then, Kira shivered, and then they would go to FTL and leave the League far behind. It was a daunting prospect. Work had often taken her to the very fringes of settled space, but she'd never ventured so far as this. Few people had. There was no good financial reason. Only research expeditions and survey missions went out into the vast unknown. The star they were heading to was an unassuming red dwarf that had only been detected within the past 25 years. Remote analysis indicated the presence of at least 5 planets in orbit, which aligned with what the soft blade had shown her. No sign of technological activity had been picked up by the League's telescopes. 60 light years was a staggeringly enormous distance. It would put a significant strain on both the ships and the crews. The ships would have to pop in and out of FTL numerous times along the way to shed their excess heat. And while it was safe to stay in cryo for far longer than the 3 months it would take to reach the distant star, the experience would still take its toll on both mind and body. The toll would be greatest for Kira. She wasn't looking forward to enduring another bout of dreaming hibernation so soon after arriving from Sigma Draconis. Lengthwise, the duration would be similar, as the Valkyrie had been far slower than either the Wallfish or the Darmstadt. Kira just hoped she wouldn't have to starve herself again in order to convince the soft blade to induce dormancy. Thinking about what lay ahead wouldn't make it easier, so she pushed it from her mind. How is the UMC reacting to us leaving? She asked, unclasping her harness.
Not well, said Falcone. I don't know what Akawe told them back at Viborg, but it can't have made them happy because they're threatening us with all sorts of legal hellfire if we don't turn around.
Grigorovich chuckled, and his laugh echoed through the ship.
It's most amusing, their impotent rage. They seem quite panicked.
Can you blame them? Nielsen said. Falcone shook his head.
I'd hate to be the one who has to explain to Saul how and why they lost not only an entire cruiser, but also Kira and the suit.
Then Vishal said,
Captain, you should see what's happening on local news.
What channel?
RTC.
Kira switched to her overlays and searched for the channel. It came right up. And in front of her, she saw footage of a ship interior recorded from someone's implants. Screams sounded, and a man's body flew past, collided with another, smaller person. It took Kira a second to realize she was looking at the inside of the Wallfish's hold. Shit. A knotted, writhing shape swung into view, a jelly. The person recording focused on the alien just as it threw something off screen. Another scream rent the air. That scream, Kira remembered. Then she saw herself fly past, like a black spear from above, and grapple with the jelly while a long, bladed spike sprang from her skin and impaled the thrashing alien. The video froze, and in voiceover, a woman said,
Could this battlesuit be a product of the UMC's advanced weapons programs? Possibly. Other passengers confirmed that the woman was rescued from a UMC shuttle a few days before, which makes us wonder, what other technology is the League hiding from us? And then there's this incident from earlier today. Once more, a warning to sensitive viewers. The following footage contains graphic material.
The video resumed, and Kira again saw herself, this time attempting to subdue the purple-haired numinist. He smashed his head back into her face, and then she stabbed him, not so differently from the jelly. From the outside, the sight was more frightening than Kira had realized. No wonder the refugees had looked at her the way they did. She would have also. The reporter's voiceover returned.
Was this a justifiable use of force, or the reaction of a dangerous, out-of-control individual? You decide. Ellen Kaminsky was later seen being escorted to the UMCN cruiser the Darmstadt, and it seems unlikely she will ever face criminal charges. We attempted to interview the passengers who spoke with her. This was the result.
The footage resumed, and Kira saw the entropists being approached in a hallway somewhere on Malpert.
Excuse me, wait, excuse me, said the off-screen reporter. What can you tell us about Ellen Kaminsky, the woman who killed the jelly on the wallfish?
We have nothing to say, prisoner, said Vera and Joris together. They ducked their heads, hiding behind the hoods of their robes.
Next, Felix Hofer appeared, holding his niece's hand.
The jelly was going to shoot Nala here. She helped save her. She helped save all of us. As far as I'm concerned, Ellen Kaminsky is a hero.
Then the camera cut to the woman Inare, standing on the space dock, knitting away with a smug look on her face. Her tassel-eared cat peeked around her nest of curly hair from where it lay across her shoulders.
Who is she? Said Inare, and smiled in the most unsettling way. Why, she's the fury of the stars. That's who she is.
Then she laughed and turned away.
Goodbye now, little insect.
The reporter's voiceover returned as the image of Kira impaling the jelly filled the display again.
The fury of the stars. Who is this mysterious Ellen Kaminsky? Is she a new breed of super soldier? And what of her battlesuit? Is it an experimental bioweapon? Unfortunately, we may never find out.
The view shifted to a close-up of Kira's face, dark-eyed and threatening.
Whatever the truth, we know one thing well certain. Sire, the jellies must fear her. And for that, if nothing else, this reporter is grateful. Fury of the stars, Star Fury. Whoever she really is, it's good to know she's fighting on our side. For RTC News, this is Shinar Ebose.
God damn it, said Kira, closing her overlays.
Looks like we're leaving at just the right time, said Falcone.
Yeah.
Across the room, Trigg smirked and said,
Star Fury! Ha! Can I call you that now, Ms. Navarez? If you do, I'll hit you.
Nielsen tucked several loose strands of hair back into her ponytail.
This might not be the worst thing. The more people know about you, the more difficult it will be for the League to hide you away and pretend the soft blade doesn't exist.
Maybe, said Kira, unconvinced. She didn't have that much faith in the accountability of governments. If they wanted to disappear her, they would, regardless of public sentiment. Plus, she hated the exposure. It made acting with any sense of anonymity difficult to impossible. 3. With the wallfish on course and under thrust, the crew dispersed throughout the ship as they continued to ready it for the trip to come. As Trigg said,
It's been ages since we went superluminal.
There were supplies to reorganize, systems to test and prep, loose objects to store, every pen and cup and blanket and other miscellaneous item the UMC had left out after searching the wallfish had to be secured prior to the extended period of zero-G they were about to embark upon, and scores of tasks, small and large, that needed attending to. The day was already getting late, but Falcone insisted they prep while they could.
Never know what might happen tomorrow. Could end up with another batch of hostiles breathing down our necks.
His logic was difficult to argue with. At Hua Chung's request, Kira went to the cargo hold and helped her uncrate the repair bots they'd received from Malpert Station, replacements for the ones lost when they boarded the jelly ship. After a few minutes of silence, Hua Chung glanced over at Kira and said,
Thank you for killing that thing.
You mean the jelly?
Yes.
You're welcome.
I'm just glad I was able to help.
Hua Chung grunted.
If you hadn't been there.
She shook her head, and Kira saw unaccustomed emotion on the woman's face.
Someday,
I buy you soju and beef as a thank you, and we will get drunk together. You and me and little Sparrow.
I look forward to it, then Kira said. Are you okay with us going after the Staff of Blue?
Wachong never slowed as she removed a bot from its packaging.
We will be a long way from Space Dock if the Wallfish breaks. It is good the Darmstadt is with us, I think.
And the mission itself?
It needs doing. Aish. What else is there to say?
As they were finishing with the last crate, a text popped up in Kira's vision.
Come see me in Hydroponics Bay when you can, Falcone.
Be there in 5, Kira. She helped Huachong dispose of the excess packaging, and then Kira made her excuses and hurried out of the cargo hold. Once in the main shaft, she said,
Grigorovich, where's the hydro bay?
One deck up, end of the corridor, one's left, one's right, and there you shall be.
Thanks.
Bitter.
The scent of flowers greeted Kira as she approached the hydroponics bay. Flowers and herbs and algae and all manner of green and growing things. The smells reminded Kira of the greenhouses on Wayland, and of her father fussing over his midnight constellations. She felt a sudden longing to be outdoors, surrounded by living things, and not trapped on ships that stank of sweat and machine oil. The aromas multiplied as the pressure door swung open, and Kira walked into a bank of humid air. Aisles of hanging plants filled the room, along with the dark, sloshing vats that contained the algae cultures. Above, nozzles misted the rows of greenery. She stopped, struck by the sight. The bay was not unlike the one on Adrastea, where she and Alan had spent so many hours, including that last, special night when he had proposed. Sadness wafted over her, as poignant as any scent. Falcone stood near the back, bent over a work table while he trimmed a plant with a drooping, wax-petaled flower, white and delicate, of a sort Kira was unfamiliar with. His sleeves were rolled up to expose his scars. That Falcone had an interest in gardening wasn't something Kira had expected. Belatedly, she remembered the bonsai in his cabin.
You wanted to see me?
She said. Falcone clipped a leaf off the plant, then another. Each time his shears closed with a decisive snip. All of the plants had to be reprocessed before entering FTL. They couldn't survive unattended for such a long trip. And moreover, keeping them alive would produce too much waste heat. A few special ones might get put into cryo. She wasn't sure what sort of equipment the Wallfish had, but those would be the only ones saved. Falcone put down the shears and stood with both hands on the work table.
When you stab the Numinist,
Bob.
That's right, Bob the Numinist.
Falcone didn't smile, and neither did Kira.
When you stabbed him, was it you or the soft blade that did the stabbing?
Both, I think, he grunted.
Can't decide if that makes it better or worse.
Shame twisted Kira's gut. Look, it was an accident. It won't happen again. He gave her a low, sideways look.
You sure about that?
I...
Doesn't matter. We can't afford another accident like Bob. I'm not gonna let more of my crew get injured. Not by the jellies, and sure as hell not by that suit of yours. You hear me?
He fixed her with a stare. I hear you. He didn't seem convinced.
Tomorrow I want you to go see Sparrow. Talk with her. Do what she tells you. She has some ideas that might help you control the soft blade.
Kira shifted her weight, uncomfortable. I'm not arguing, but Sparrow isn't a scientist. She...
I don't think you need a scientist, said Falcone.
His brow knotted.
I think you need discipline and structure. I think you need training. You fucked up with the Numinist, and you fucked up on the jelly ship. If you can't keep that thing of yours on a leash, you need to stay in your quarters from now on for the sake of everyone.
He wasn't wrong, but his tone rankled her.
How much training do you think I can do? We're leaving Signy day after tomorrow.
And you're not going into cryo,
Falcone retorted.
Yes, but...
His glare intensified.
Do what you can. Go see Sparrow. Sort your shit out. This isn't a debate.
The back of Kira's neck prickled, and she squared her shoulders.
Are you making that an order?
Since you asked, yes. Is that all?
Falcone turned back to the workbench.
That's all. Get out of here.
Kira got. 4. After that, Kira didn't feel much like interacting with the rest of the crew. Not for work, and not for dinner. She retreated to her cabin. With the lights dimmed and her overlays turned off, the room appeared particularly bare, cramped, and shabby. She sat on the bed and stared at the battered walls, and found nothing in their appearance to like. Kira wanted to be angry. She was angry, but she couldn't bring herself to blame Falcone. In his place, she would have done the same. Even so, she remained unconvinced that Sparrow could be of any help. She covered her face with her hands. Part of her wanted to believe that she wasn't responsible for answering the compulsion on the jelly ship, or for stabbing Bob the Numinist. But somehow the suit had twisted her mind, acted of its own volition, either out of ignorance or a desire to seed its own destructive mischief. But she knew better. No one had forced her to do either thing. In both cases, she'd wanted to. Blaming her actions on the soft blade was only an excuse, an easy out from the harsh reality. She took a shivering breath. Not everything had gone wrong, of course. Learning about the Staff of Blue was an unalloyed good, and Kira hoped with every fiber of her being that she hadn't misunderstood, and that finding it would lead to a favorable outcome. Even so, the thought did nothing to reduce the guilt that gnawed at her. Kira couldn't bring herself to rest, tired though she was. Her mind was too active, too wired. Instead, she activated her cabin's console and checked the news on Wayland. It was exactly as Akawe had said, and then started to read everything she could find about the nightmares. It wasn't much. They were so recently arrived in both 61 Cygni and elsewhere, no one had been able to do a proper analysis of them. At least not at the time of the broadcast that had reached Cygni. She'd been sitting there for perhaps half an hour when a message from Grigorovich appeared in the corner of her vision.
The crew is gathering in the mess hall if you wish to partake, O spiky meatbag. Grigorovich.
Kira closed the message and kept reading. Not 15 minutes later, a loud pounding on the door jolted her. From outside came Nielsen's voice.
Kira, I know you're there. Come join us. You need to eat.
Kira's mouth was so dry, it took her 3 tries before she was able to muster enough moisture to answer.
No, thanks. I'm fine.
Nonsense. Open up.
No.
Metal clanked and screeched as the wheel outside the pressure door turned, and then the door itself swung open. Kira sat back and crossed her arms, somewhat offended. Out of habit, she'd thrown the privacy lock. No one should have been able to barge in on her, even though she knew half the crew probably could override the lock. Nielsen entered and looked down at her with an exasperated expression. Defensive, Kira forced herself to meet the woman's gaze.
Let's go, said Nielsen. The food's warm. It's just microwave rations, but you'll feel better with something in you.
It's okay, I'm not hungry. Nielsen studied her for a moment, and then closed the door to the cabin, and, to Kira's surprise, sat on the other end of the bed.
No, it's not okay. How long are you going to stay in here?
Kira shrugged. The surface of the soft blade prickled.
I'm tired, that's all. Just don't want to see anyone.
Why?
What are you afraid of?
For a moment, Kira wasn't going to answer. Then, defiant, she said,
Myself, all right? Happy now?
Nielsen seemed unimpressed.
So you screwed up. Everyone screws up. What matters is how you deal with it. Hiding isn't the answer. It never is.
Yeah, but... Kira had difficulty finding the words.
But...
I don't know if I can control the soft blade,
Kira blurted out.
There.
She'd said it.
If I get angry again, or excited, or... I don't know what might happen, and...
She trailed off, miserable. Nielsen snorted.
Bullshit.
I don't believe you. Shocked, Kira failed to find a response before the first officer said,
You're perfectly capable of eating dinner with us and not killing anyone. I know, alien parasite and all that.
She gazed at Kira from under her brow. You lost control because Bob the Numinist broke your nose. That's enough to piss off anyone. No, you shouldn't have stabbed him. And maybe you shouldn't have responded to the signal on the jelly ship. But you did. It's done, and that's the end of it. You know what to watch out for now, and you won't let it happen again. You're just scared to face everyone. That's what you're afraid of.
You're wrong. You don't understand what...
I understand plenty. You messed up, and it's hard to go out and look them in the eye. So what? The worst thing you can do is hide here and act like nothing happened. If you want to earn their trust back, come out, take your licks, and I guarantee they'll respect you for it. Even Falcone. Everyone screws up, Kira.
Not like this, Kira mumbled. How many people have you stabbed?
Nielsen's expression grew tart. So did her voice.
You think you're so special?
I don't see anyone else infected with an alien parasite. A loud bang as Nielsen slapped the wall. Kira jumped, startled.
See? You're fine, said Nielsen. You didn't stab me, imagine that. Everyone screws up, Kira. Everyone has their own shit they deal with. If you weren't stuck so far up your own ass, you'd see. Those scars on Falcone's arms, they're not a reward for avoiding mistakes, I can tell you that.
Kira trailed off, ashamed.
Nielsen leveled a finger at her. Trig hasn't had it easy either. Nor Vishal, nor Sparrow, nor Huachung. And Grigorovich is just chock full of wise life decisions.
Her mocking tone left no doubt about the actual truth.
Everyone messes up.
How you deal with it is what determines who you are.
What about you? Me? We're not here to talk about me. Pull yourself together, Kira.
You're better than this. Nielsen stood.
Wait. Why do you care?
For the first time, Nielsen's expression softened. Just slightly. Because that's what we do. We fall down, and then we help each other back up again. The door creaked as she opened it.
Are you coming?
The food is still warm.
Yeah, I'm coming.
And though it wasn't easy, Kira got to her feet. 5. It was well past midnight, but everyone was in the galley except for Sparrow and the Marines. Despite Kira's fears, no one made her feel unwelcome, although she couldn't help feeling that everyone was judging her and that she was lacking. Still, the crew didn't say anything unpleasant, and the only time the subject of the Numinist came up was when Trig made a sideways reference to him, which Kira, taking Nielsen's advice from before, acknowledged in a straightforward manner. There was some kindness as well. Huachung brought her a cup of tea, and Vishal said,
You come see me tomorrow, yes? I will fix your nose for you.
Falcone snorted. He had barely looked at her.
It's gonna hurt like hell if anesthetic doesn't work on you.
That's all right, said Kira. It wasn't, but pride and a sense of responsibility wouldn't let her admit otherwise. Everyone seemed exhausted, and for the most part, the galley was silent. Each person lost in their own thoughts, eyes focused on overlays. Kira had just started eating when the entropist surprised her by sitting in front of her. They leaned in over the top of the table, eager eyes in eager faces, twins with different bodies.
Yes,
she said. Vera said,
Prisoner Navarez, we have discovered.
The most exciting thing, as we were making our way across Malpert Station, we came across the remains of one of the nightmares and
we succeeded in taking a tissue sample.
Kira perked up.
Oh?
The entropist gripped the edge of the table together, their fingernails whitened with the pressure.
We have spent all this time
studying the sample, what it shows.
Yes,
she said.
What it shows, Joris continued, is that the nightmares don't share the same genomic makeup as either the soft blade or the jellies.
The entropist sat back, smiling with evident delight at their discovery. Kira put down her fork.
Are you telling me there are no similarities?
Vera bobbed her head.
Similarities, yes, but
only similarities born of basic chemical necessity. Otherwise, the entities are entirely unalike. That confirmed Kira's initial instinctual reaction. But still, she wondered.
One of the nightmares had tentacles. I saw it. What about that?
The entropists nodded together, as if pleased.
Yes, in form familiar, but in substance foreign. You may have also seen
arms and legs, and eyes and fur, and other
growths reminiscent of Earth-based life. But the nightmare we examined contained
no closeness to Terran DNA.
Kira stared at the pile of soggy rations on her plate as she thought.
What are they, then?
A paired shrug from the entropists.
Unknown, said Joris. Their underlying biological structure appears
unformed. Incomplete. Contradictory.
Malignant.
Huh. Can I see your results?
Of course, prisoner.
She looked back up at them. Have you shared this with the Darmstadt yet?
We just sent over our files.
Good. Akawe should know the sorts of creatures they were dealing with. The entropists returned to their own table, and Kira slowly continued eating as she scoured the documents they'd sent her. It amazed her the amount of data they'd been able to gather without a proper lab. The tech built into their robes was seriously impressive. She paused when the four Marines showed up in their drab olive greens. Even out of power armor, the men were imposing. Their bodies bulged and rippled with unnatural levels of lean muscle, living anatomy charts that screamed of strength, power, and speed. Their physiques the result of a whole suite of genetic tweaks the military employed in their frontline troops. Even though none of them looked like they'd grown up in high G like Hua Chung, Kira had no doubt they were just as strong, if not more so. They reminded her of pictures she'd seen of animals with myostatin deficiencies. Hawes, Sanchez. She didn't know the names of the other two. The Marines didn't stay to eat. Just heated water for tea or coffee, grabbed a few snacks, and left.
Won't be getting in your way, Captain,
said Hawes on the way out. Falcone gave them a casual salute. The technical details of the nightmare's biology were deep and varied, and Kira found herself lost in the more obscure points. Everything the entropists had said was true, but they had barely begun to capture the sheer weirdness of the nightmares. By comparison, the jellies, with all their genetic manipulation, were positively straightforward. But the nightmares. Kira had never seen anything resembling them. She kept stumbling across snatches of chemical sequences that seemed familiar, but only seemed. The cellular structure of the nightmares wasn't even stable, and as for how that was possible, she hadn't the slightest idea. Her plate had long been empty, and she was still reading when a glass thumped down next to her plate, causing her to jump. Falcone stood next to her, holding a bouquet of glasses in one hand and several bottles of red wine in the other. Without asking, he filled her glass halfway. Here. Then he walked around, handing out glasses to the crew and entropists and filling them. Finished, he lifted his own glass.
Kira. Things didn't work out how any of us expected. But if it weren't for you, there's a good chance we'd all be dead.
Yeah, it's been a rough day.
Yeah, you ticked off every jelly from here to Kingdom Come. And yeah, we're racing off to God knows where because of you.
He paused, his gaze steady.
But we're alive. Trig is alive. Sparrow is alive. And we have you to thank for that. So this toast is for you, Kira.
At first, no one else joined in. Then Nielsen reached out and lifted her own glass.
Hear, hear,
she said, and the others echoed her. An unexpected film of tears blurred Kira's vision. She raised her wine and mumbled thanks. For the first time, she didn't feel quite so horribly out of place on the Wallfish.
And in the future, let's not do any of this again, said Falcone, sitting down.
A few chuckles followed. Kira eyed her drink. Half a glass, not too much. She downed it in a single motion, and then sat back, curious what would happen. Across the mess hall, Falcone gave her a wary look. A minute passed. 5 minutes. 10. And still Kira felt nothing. She made a face, disgusted. After the abstinence of the past few months, she ought to have gotten at least a slight buzz. But no. The soft blade was suppressing the effects of the alcohol. Even if she'd wanted to get drunk, she couldn't. It shouldn't have, but the realization angered Kira.
Damn you,
she muttered. No one, not even the soft blade, ought to be able to dictate what she could do with her body. If she wanted to get a tattoo or become fat or have a kid or do anything else, then she damn well ought to have that freedom. Without the opportunity, she was nothing more than a slave. Her anger made her want to march over, grab a wine bottle, and drink the whole thing in a single go, just to force the issue, just to prove that she could. But she didn't. After what had happened that day, it terrified her to think of what the soft blade might do if she were drunk. And then, too, she didn't want to get hammered. Not really. So she didn't ask for more wine, content to hold and wait, and not to tempt misfortune. And Kira noticed that although Falcone poured out a second round for everyone else, he didn't offer one to her. He understood. And she was grateful, if still a little resentful. Dangerous or not, she wanted the choice.
Anyone want the rest?
Falcone asked, holding up the last bottle. It was still about a quarter full. Huachong took it from him.
Me, I will. I have extra enzymes.
The crew chuckled, and Kira felt relieved that she no longer had to think about the wine. She turned the stem of the glass between her fingers, and a faint smile crept onto her face. With it, she felt a sense of lightness. Nielsen had been right. It was good she'd come out to face the crew. Hiding hadn't been the answer. It was a lesson she needed to remember. 6. A green light was glowing at the desk console when Kira finally arrived back at her cabin, late that night. She stubbed her toe on the corner of the bed as she walked to the desk.
Ow!
She muttered, more out of reflex than any actual pain. As expected, the message was from Grigorovich.
I know what you can do, but I still do not know what you are. Again, I ask and asking wonder, what are you, O multifarious meatbag, Grigorovich?
She blinked and then typed her response. I am what I am, Kira. His reply was nearly instantaneous.
Bah! How pedestrian, how boring,
Grigorovich. Tough, sometimes we don't get what we want, Kira.
Heave and bluster, boil and froth, you can't conceal the void within your words. If knowledge were yours, then confidence too, but tisn't, so isn't. Cracked the pedestal, and perilous the statue that stands above. Grigorovich.
Blank verse, seriously? Is that the best you can do? Kira. A long pause followed, and for the first time she felt as if she'd one-upped him. Then,
amusements are hard to find when one finds oneself bonded in a nutshell, Grigorovich.
And yet you might rightly be counted as a king of infinite space, Kira.
Were it not that I have bad dreams, Grigorovich?
Were it not for the bad dreams, Kira.
Dot, 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 Grigorovich.
She tapped a fingernail against the console. It's not easy, is it, Kira?
Why should it be? Nature has no regard for those who squirm and crawl within its tainted depths. The storm that batters, batters all. None are spared, not you, not I, not the stars in the sky. We bind our cloaks and bend our heads and focus on our lives. But the storm, it never breaks, never fades, Grigorovich.
Cheery? Thinking about it doesn't really help, does it? The best we can do, as you said, bend our heads and focus on our lives. Kira.
So don't think. Be a sleeper devoid of dreams, Grigorovich.
Maybe I will. Kira.
That doesn't change the fact. The question remains. What are you, O Queen of Tentacles, Grigorovich?
Call me that again and I'll find a way to put hot sauce in your nutrient bath, Kira.
An empty promise from an empty voice. The fearful mind cannot accept its limits. It shrieks and flees before admitting ignorance, unable to face the threat to its identity. Grigorovich.
You don't know what you're talking about. Kira.
Deny, deny, deny. It matters not. The truth of what you are will out, regardless. When it does, the choice is yours. Believe or don't believe. I care not which. I, for one, shall be prepared, whatever the answer may be. Until that time, I'll spend my hours in watching you. Watching most intently, O formless one. Grigorovich.
Watch all you like. You won't find what you're looking for. Kira. She closed the display with a flick of her finger. To her relief, the green light stayed dull and dead. The ship mind's banter had left her unsettled. Still, she was glad she'd held her ground. Despite his assertions, Grigorovich was wrong. She knew who she was. She just didn't know what the damn suit was. Not really. Enough. She'd had enough. She removed the Entropist gem-like token from her pocket and slipped it into the desk drawer. It would be safer there than if she carried it around everywhere. Then, with a grateful sigh, she peeled off her torn clothes. A quick scrub with a wet towel, and she fell into the bunk and wrapped herself in a blanket. For a time, Kira couldn't stop her mind from cycling. Images of the jellies and the dead nightmare kept intruding, and at times Kira imagined she could smell the acrid scent Falcone's grenades produced when they exploded. Again and again, she felt the soft blade sliding into the flesh of the jelly. And then that became confused with her memory of stabbing the Numinist, and of Alan, dead in her arms. So many mistakes. So very many mistakes. It was a struggle. But in the end, she managed to fall asleep. And despite what she'd said to Grigorovich, Kira dreamed. And while she dreamed, there came to her another vision. In the golden light of summer's eve, the sounds of shrieking filled the hungry forest. She sat upon a prominence, watching the play of life among the purple trees, while awaiting the expected return of her companions. Below, a centipede-like creature scurried forth from the gloom-shrouded underbrush and darted into a burrow beneath a clump of roots. Chasing it was a long-armed, snake-necked, sloth-bodied predator, with a head like a toothed worm, and legs that jointed backward. The hunter snapped at the burrow, but too slow to catch its prey. Frustrated, the snake-necked sloth sat on its haunches and tore with hooked and knobbled fingers at the earthen hole, hissing from its slitted mouth. It dug and dug, growing more agitated the whole while. The roots were hard, the ground rocky, and little progress was made. Then the hunter reached into the burrow with one long finger, attempting to scoop out the centipede. A screech rang forth as the snake-necked sloth yanked back its hand. Blackish blood dripped from finger's end. The creature howled, though not with pain, but with anger. It thrashed its head and trampled across the underbrush, crushing fronds and flowers and fruiting bodies. Again it howled, and then it grabbed the nearest trunk and shook it with such force the tree swayed. A crack echoed among the sweltering forest, and a cluster of spiked seed pods fell from the canopy and struck the sloth on the head and shoulders. It yelped and collapsed into the dirt where it lay twitching and kicking while foam formed at the corners of its gaping maw. In time, the kicking stopped. Later still, the centipede-like creature ventured forth from its burrow, slow and timid. It climbed onto the slack neck of the sloth and sat there, feelers twitching. Then it bent and began to eat the soft meat of the throat. Another of the now familiar disjunctions. She was crouched next to a tidal pool, shadowed from the heat of the harsh sun by a spur of volcanic rock. In the pool floated a translucent orb no bigger than her thumb. The orb was not alive, but it was not dead. It was a thing in between, a potential unrealized. She watched with hope, waiting for the moment of transformation, when potential might become actuality. There,
a soft movement of light from within, and the orb pulsed as if taking its first tentative breath. Happiness and wonder replaced hope at the gift of first life. What had been done would change all the fractures to follow. First here, and then, given time and fortune, in the great whirl of stars beyond. And she saw it was good. Chapter 12. Lessons. 1. Kira felt surprisingly well rested when she woke. A thick layer of dust fell from her body as she sat up. She stretched and spat out the few grains that fell into her mouth. The dust tasted like slate. She started to stand and realized she was sitting in a hole in the bedding. During the night, the soft blade had absorbed most of the blanket and mattress, as well as part of the composite frame beneath. Only a few centimeters of material still separated her from the reclamation equipment below. Kira guessed the Xeno must have needed to replenish itself after fighting the previous day. In fact, it felt thicker, as if it was adapting in response to the threats they'd faced. The fibers on her chest and forearms in particular seemed harder, more robust. The responsiveness of the suit continued to impress her. "You know we're at war, don't you?" she murmured. She turned on her console to find a message waiting for her.
"Come see me once you're up, Sparrow."
Kira made a face. She wasn't looking forward to whatever Sparrow had planned for her. If it could help with the soft blade, then great, but Kira wasn't convinced. Still, if she wanted to avoid antagonizing Falcone, then she had to play along, and she did need to figure out a better way to control the Xeno. She closed Sparrow's text and wrote to Grigorovich instead. "My bed and blankets need to be replaced. The suit ate through them last night. If it's not too much trouble for a ship mind such as yourself, of course. Kira." His reply was nearly instantaneous. Sometimes she envied the speed with which ship minds could think, but then she remembered how much she liked having a body.
"Perhaps you should try feeding your ravenous leech something better than a smorgasbord of polycarbonates. It simply can't be good for a growing parasite, Grigorovich."
"Have any suggestions, Kira?"
"Why, yes. Yes, I do. If your charming little symbiont insists upon chewing on my bones, I'd rather it be somewhere away from needed systems like, oh, say, life support. In the machine room, we have raw stock for printing and repairs. Something in there should appeal to the palate of your alien overlord. Check with Hua Chong. She can show you where it is, Grigorovich."
Kira raised her eyebrows. He was actually trying to be helpful, even if he couldn't stop insulting her. "Why, thank you. I'll be sure to save you from immediate disintegration when my alien overlords take over the system. Kira."
"Ah-ha-ha, ah-ha-ha-ha. Truly, that's the funniest thing I've heard this century. You're killing me here. Why don't you go cause some trouble like a good monkey? That seems to be what you're best at, Grigorovich."
She rolled her eyes and closed the window. Then, after dressing in her old jumpsuit and taking a moment to gather her thoughts, she activated the display camera and recorded a message for her family, much as she had on the Valkyrie. Only this time, Kira made no attempt to hide the truth. "We found an alien artifact on Adrastea," she said. "I found it, actually." She told them everything that had happened from then on, including the attack on the extenuating circumstances. Now that the existence of the soft blade was public knowledge, Kira saw no point in keeping the details from her family, no matter how the UMC or the League might have classified the information. Following that, she recorded a similar message for Alan's brother. Her eyes were full of tears by the time she finished. She allowed them to flow freely, and then wiped her cheeks dry with the heels of her hands. Accessing the Wallfish's transmitter, she queued the two messages for delivery to 61 Cygni's nearest FTL relay. There was a good chance the League would intercept any signals from the Wallfish. There was an equally good chance that the Jellies were jamming her home system, as they had 61 Cygni, and that the message for her family wouldn't get through. But she had to try, and Kira took some comfort in knowing that a record of her words existed. As long as they remained preserved somewhere in the circuits and memory banks of the League's computers, they might eventually reach their intended recipients.
Either way, she'd fulfilled her responsibility as best she could, and it was a weight off her mind. She spent the next few minutes writing an account of the most recent dream from the Softblade. Then, resigned to what she felt sure was going to be an unpleasant experience with Sparrow, she hurried out of the cabin and headed toward the galley. As she descended along the central ladder, Kira felt a sharp pain in her lower abdomen. She sucked in her breath, surprised, and stopped where she was. That was odd. She waited a little while, but didn't feel anything else. An upset stomach from the food the previous night or a small muscle strain, she guessed. Nothing to worry about. She continued climbing. At the galley, she set water to boil and then texted Vishal. "Does Sparrow prefer tea or coffee, Kira?" She figured she couldn't go wrong by starting off with a peace offering. The doctor answered just as the water boiled.
"Coffee, and the blacker the better, Vishal."
"Thanks, Kira." She made two cups, one chel and one double-strength coffee. Then she carried the mugs to sickbay and knocked on the pressure door.
"Mind if I come in?"
"Door's unlocked," said Sparrow.
Kira pushed it open with her shoulder, careful not to spill the drinks. Sparrow was sitting upright on the infirmary bed, perfectly manicured hands folded across her belly, a hollow display open in front of her. She didn't look too bad, considering. Her skin actually had some color, and her eyes were sharp and alert. Several layers of bandages wrapped her waist, and a small square machine was clipped to the top of her pants.
"I was wondering when you'd show up," she said.
"Is this a bad time?"
"It's the only time we've got."
Kira held out the mug with the two shots. "Vishal said you like coffee." Sparrow accepted the mug.
"I do. Although it makes me pee, and going to the bathroom is a pain in the ass right now. Literally."
"Do you want chel instead? I have some."
"No."
Sparrow inhaled the steam wafting from the coffee.
"No, this is perfect. Thank you."
Kira pulled over the doctor's stool and sat. "How are you feeling?"
"Good, considering."
Sparrow grimaced.
"My side itches like crazy, and the doc says there's nothing he can do about it. Plus, I can't digest food properly. He's been feeding me through a drip."
"Is he going to be able to patch you up before we leave?" Sparrow took another sip.
"Surgery's scheduled for tonight."
She looked at Kira.
"Thanks for stopping that jelly, by the way. I owe you."
"You would have done the same," said Kira. The small, hard-faced woman smirked.
"Suppose I woulda. Might not have done any good without you, Zeno. You're one scary mofo when you're angry."
The praise sat badly with Kira. "I just wish I could have gotten there faster."
"Don't beat yourself up about it."
Sparrow smiled more openly.
"We gave those jellies a hell of a surprise, eh?"
"Yeah. You heard about the nightmares."
"Sure did."
Sparrow gestured at the display.
"I was just reading the reports. Real shame what happened to Ruslan's beanstalk. If only they'd had a proper defense network, they might have been able to save it."
Kira blew on her chel. "You were in the UMC, weren't you?"
"UMCM, technically. 14th Division Europa Command. 7 years enlisted. Ooh, rah, rah, baby."
"That's how you got Milcom access."
"You know it. Use my lieutenant's old login."
A feral smile crossed Sparrow's lips.
"He was a bastard anyway."
She cleared the display with an unnecessarily violent swipe.
"They really should change those codes more often."
"So now you work security, is that it? You don't just pick things up and put them down?"
"No, not really."
Sparrow scratched her side.
"Most days it's pretty boring. Eat shit, sleep, repeat. Sometimes it's more exciting. Knock a few heads together, cover Falcone's back when he's making deals, keep an eye on the cargo when we're docked. That sort of thing. It's a living. Beats sitting in a VR tank waiting to get old."
Kira could relate. She'd felt much the same when deciding to pursue xenobiology as a career.
"And every once in a while," said Sparrow,
bright fire kindling in her eyes,
"you end up at the pointy end of the knife like we did yesterday, and then you get to find out what you're made of, don't ya?"
"Yes." Sparrow studied her, serious.
"Speaking of knocking heads together, I saw that video of what you did to Bob."
Another small, quick pain lanced her abdomen. Kira ignored it. "You knew him?"
"I met him. Vishal had him in here, pissing and moaning while he got stitched up. So what went wrong in the hold?"
"Falcone must have told you." Sparrow shrugged.
"Sure, but I'd rather hear it from you."
The surface of Kira's chel was dark and oily.
On it, she could see her face in a warped reflection. Short version? I got hurt. I wanted it to stop, I lashed out. Or rather, the soft blade lashed out for me. It's sometimes hard to tell the difference.
Were you angry? Did Bob's idiot maneuver get under your skin?
Yeah, it did.
Uh-huh.
Sparrow caught her gaze by pointing at Kira's face.
That nose of yours must have caused all sorts of pain when it broke.
She touched it, self-conscious. Have you broken yours?
3 times. Got it straightened out, though.
Kira struggled to find the right words. Look, don't take this the wrong way, Sparrow, but I really don't see how you can help me with the Xeno. I'm here because Falcone insisted, but... Sparrow cocked her head.
Do you know what the military does? Let me tell you. The military accepts everyone who volunteers, assuming they meet the basic requirements. That means at one end of the spectrum, you get people who'd just as soon cut your throat as shake your hand. And at the other end of the spectrum, you get people so timid they wouldn't hurt a fly. And what the military does is teach both of them how and when to apply violence. That and how to take orders. A trained Marine doesn't go around stabbing guys just because they broke their nose. That would be a disproportionate use of force. You pull a stunt like that in the UMC and you'll be lucky to get court-martialed. And that's if you don't get yourself or your team killed. Losing your temper is a cop-out. A cheap cop-out. You don't get to lose your temper. Not when lives are on the line. Violence is a tool. Nothing more, nothing less. And its use should be as carefully calibrated as the cuts of a surgeon's scalpel.
Kira raised an eyebrow. You sound more like a philosopher than a fighter.
What, you think all jawheads are stupid?
Sparrow chuckled before going serious again.
All good soldiers are philosophers. Same as a priest or a professor. You have to be when you deal with matters of life and death.
Did you see any action when you were in the service?
Oh, yeah.
She eyed Kira.
You think the galaxy's a peaceful place. And it is, for the most part. Ignoring the jellies, your odds of getting hurt or killed in a violent encounter are lower now than at any other time in history. And yet, more people are actually fighting. Fighting and dying than ever before. You know why?
Because there are more people alive now, said Kira.
Bingo. The percentages have gotten lower, but the overall numbers keep going up.
Sparrow shrugged.
So yeah, we saw a lot of action.
Kira took her first sip of chow. It was rich and warm, with a spicy aftertaste like cinnamon. Her belly was hurting again, and she rubbed it without thinking. All right, but I still don't see how you can help me control the suit.
I probably can't, but I might be able to help you control yourself. And that's the next best thing.
We don't have a lot of time. Sparrow thumped herself on the chest.
I don't, but you're gonna have a whole hell of a lot of time while the rest of us are stuck in cryo.
And I'm gonna spend most of it sleeping.
Most. Not all.
Sparrow flashed a quick grin.
That gives you a real opportunity, Navarez. You can practice. You can better yourself. And ain't that what we all want? To be the best we can be.
Kira gave her a skeptical look. That sounds like a recruitment slogan.
Yeah, well, maybe it is, said Sparrow. So sue me.
She gingerly swung her legs over the edge of the exam table and slid down to the floor. You need help? Sparrow shook her head and with a wince straightened her posture.
I can manage. Thanks.
She picked up a crutch next to the bed.
So, have I recruited you or not?
I don't think I have much of a choice, but...
Sure you do.
But yes, I'm willing to give it a shot.
Outstanding, said Sparrow. That's what I wanted to hear.
And she swung forward on her crutch and headed out of sick bay.
This way.
Kira shook her head, put down her cup, and followed. At the central shaft, Sparrow slid an arm through the center of the crutch and started to climb down the ladder, careful in her movements. She grimaced with obvious discomfort.
Thank God for painkillers, she said.
Down the shaft they went to the bottom deck. There, Sparrow led Kira into the port cargo hold. Kira hadn't seen much of it before. It mirrored the layout of the starboard hold, the main difference being the racks of supplies and equipment bolted to the floor. The 4 Marines had taken over a section between the aisles. There, they'd set up their suits of power armor, as well as their cryo tubes, sleeping bags, and various hard cases of weapons, and Thule knew what else. At the moment, Hawks was doing pull-ups on a bar placed between 2 of the racks, while the other three Marines were practicing throws and disarms on a patch of clear deck. They paused and straightened up when they noticed Kira and Sparrow.
Yo-yo,
said one of the men. He had thick, dark eyebrows and lines of blue script in some language Kira didn't recognize tattooed up and down the muscles of his bare arms. The tattoos shifted as he moved, like long waves on water. He pointed at Sparrow.
You were the one what got perforated by the jelly, yeah?
That's right, Marine. Then he pointed at Kira.
And you were the one what perforated the jelly right quick, yeah?
Kira dipped her head. Yeah. For a moment, she wasn't sure how the man was going to react. Then he broke into a big smile. His teeth glittered with implanted nanowires.
Well done. Most excellent.
He gave them both a big thumbs up. One of the other Marines approached them. He was shorter, with huge shoulders and hands nearly as big as Hua Chung's. Looking at Kira, he said,
That means you're the reason we're off on this crazy-ass trip.
She lifted her chin. Afraid so.
Hey, not complaining. If it gets us the jump on the jellies, I'm all for it. You convinced old man Akawe, so you're good by me.
He held out one of his paw-like hands.
Corporal Nishu.
Kira shook. His grip felt like it could crush rocks. Kira Navarez. The corporal jerked his chin toward the tattooed Marine.
This ugly lug is Private Tattoo Poa. That one over there is Sanchez.
He pointed at a thin-faced Marine with mournful eyes.
And of course you met the lieutenant.
Yes, I did. Kira shook with Tattoo Poa and Sanchez and said, Pleased to meet you. Glad you're on board. She wasn't sure if she was, but it was the right thing to say. Sanchez said,
Any idea what to expect when we arrive at this system, ma'am?
The staff of Blue, I hope, said Kira. Sorry, I can't tell you any more. That's all I know myself. Then Hawks came over.
All right, that's enough, everyone. Let the ladies be. I'm sure they're busy.
Nishu and Tattoo Poa gave them salutes and went back to grappling, while Sanchez watched from the side. Sparrow started past, and then she paused and looked at Tattoo Poa.
You're doing it wrong, by the way, she said.
The man blinked.
Excuse me, ma'am?
When you tried to throw him,
she indicated the corporal.
I think we know what we're after, ma'am. No offense.
You should listen to her, said Kira. She was in the UMCM also.
Next to her, Sparrow stiffened, and Kira had a sudden feeling she'd made a mistake. Hawes stepped forward.
That's so, ma'am. Where'd you serve? Doesn't matter, said Sparrow.
To the man with the tattoo, she said,
Your weight needs to be more on your front foot. Step forward like you mean it and pivot, hard. You'll feel the difference immediately.
Then Sparrow continued on her way, leaving the four Marines looking after her with a combination of bemusement and speculation. Sorry about that, said Kira once they were out of sight. Sparrow grunted.
As I said, doesn't matter.
The tip of her crutch caught on the side of a shelving unit, and she yanked it free.
Over here.
Buried at the back of the hold past the crates of rations and pallets of equipment, Kira saw three things. A treadmill, rigged up for use in zero-G. An exercise machine, all cables and pulleys and angle grips of the sort she'd used on the Fidanza. And to her surprise, a full set of free weights, dumbbells and barbells and anchored piles of weighted discs, giant poker chips colored red, green, blue, and yellow. When every kilo cost you in propellant, every kilo became precious. The gym was a minor extravagance of a sort Kira hadn't expected to find on the Wallfish.
Yours?
She asked, gesturing at the weights.
Yeah, said Sparrow. And Hua Chung's. Takes a lot to keep her fit in 1G.
With a huff, she lowered herself onto the bench and stretched her left leg out in front. She pressed a hand against her side over the bandages.
You know the worst part about being injured?
Not being able to work out?
Bingo.
Sparrow gestured at her body.
This doesn't happen by accident, you know.
There was nowhere else to sit, so Kira squatted next to the bench.
Really? Didn't you get gene hack like those guys?
She motioned back toward the Marines.
I read somewhere that with the tweaks you get in the UMC, you can sit around eating whatever you want and still be in shape. It's not quite that easy, said Sparrow. You still have to do cardio if you don't want to get gassed, and you still have to work hard if you want to build top-end strength. Gene hacks help, but they sure as fuck ain't magic. As for those apes, there are degrees. Not everyone gets the same mods.
Our guests are what are called R7s. Means they got the full set of augments. You gotta volunteer for them, though. As it ain't healthy long term. The UMC won't let you run like that for more than 15 years, tops.
Huh, I didn't know, said Kira. She looked back at the weights.
So why are we here? What's the plan?
Sparrow scratched the side of her blade-like jaw.
Haven't you figured it out? You're gonna lift weights. And what?
The short-haired woman chuckled.
Here's the deal, Navarez. I don't know you particularly well, but I do know that every time you screw up with the Xeno, it seems to be when you're stressed. Fear, anger, frustration, that sort of thing. Am I wrong?
No.
Right. So the name of the game is discomfort. We're going to impose some carefully calibrated stress, and we're going to see what that does to you and the soft blade. Okay?
Okay, said Kira, cautious. Sparrow pointed at the exercise machine.
Was that simple-like, since that's all I can count on from you?
Kira wanted to argue, but the woman had a point. So Kira swallowed her pride and sat. One by one, Sparrow talked her through a series of lifts, testing her strength and the strength of the soft blade, first on the machine and then with the free weights. The results, Kira thought, were impressive. With the soft blade's help, she was able to move nearly as much as a heavy exoskeleton. Her relative lack of mass was the greatest limiting factor. The slightest wobble of the weight threatened to unbalance her. Sparrow didn't seem much pleased. As Kira struggled to squat a bar loaded with an absurd number of plates, the woman tisked and said,
"Shit, you really don't know what you're doing."
With a growl, Kira straightened her legs and dumped the bar onto the waiting rack, and then glared at Sparrow.
"The suit's protecting you from your bad form."
"So tell me what I'm doing wrong," said Kira.
"Sorry, Buttercup. Not what we're here for today. Put another 20 kilos on, then try to use the suit to brace against the floor. Like a tripod."
Kira tried. She really did. But the weight was more than her knees could withstand, and she wasn't able to split her attention between the soft blade and the effort of balancing a bar that was more than heavy enough to kill her. She could stiffen the material around her legs. That much she could do. But extruding any sort of support at the same time was beyond her. And the Xeno didn't seem inclined to provide additional help on its own. Quite the opposite, in fact. Beneath her jumpsuit, Kira felt the suit shifting and forming spikes in response to the strain. She tried to still herself, and by extension the suit, but was only partially successful.
"Yeah," said Sparrow as Kira racked the bar. "That's what I thought. Okay, over here, on the mat."
Kira obeyed, and the moment she was in place, Sparrow threw a small, hard object at her. Without thinking, Kira ducked. And at the same time, the soft blade lashed out with a pair of tendrils and smacked away whatever the object was. Sparrow dropped flat on the bench, a small blaster appearing in her hands. All emotion had vanished from her face, replaced by the flat-eyed intensity of someone about to fight for their life. In that instant, Kira realized the woman's bravado was just that, a cover, and that she was treating Kira with the same caution as a live grenade. The skin around Sparrow's eyes tightened with pain as she pushed herself back up.
"As I said, you need practice. Discipline."
She tucked the blaster into a pocket in her slacks. By the bulkhead, Kira saw what Sparrow had thrown at her, a white therapy ball.
"Sorry," said Kira, "I..." "Don't bother, Navarez. We know what the problem is. That's why you're here. That's what we have to fix."
Kira ran a hand over the curve of her skull. "You can't fix the instinct for self-preservation."
"Oh, yes, we can,"
Sparrow snapped.
"That's what separates us from the animals. We can choose to go out and march for 30 clicks with a heavy ruck on our back. We can choose to put up with all sorts of unpleasant shit because we know our tomorrow selves will thank us for it. Doesn't matter what kind of mental gymnastics you have to pull in that mush you call a brain, but there is sure as shit a way to keep from overreacting when you get surprised. For fuck's sake. I saw Marines out drinking their morning coffee while our point defense was picking off an assload of incoming missiles, and they were the coolest, calmest motherfuckers I ever saw. A little poker game going with bets to see how many missiles would get through. So if they could do it, you sure as hell can. Even if you are bonded with an alien parasite."
Somewhat abashed, Kira nodded, took a breath, and with a concerted effort, smoothed the last few bumps on the soft blade. "You're right."
Sparrow jerked her head. "You're damn right I'm right."
Then, just because,
Kira asked. What sort of drugs did Vishal pump into you?
Not enough, that's for sure. Let's try something different.
Then Sparrow put her on the treadmill and had her alternate between running sprints and attempting to coax the soft blade into performing certain tasks, mainly reshaping itself according to Sparrow's instructions. Kira found she couldn't concentrate past her panting and the pounding of her heart. The distractions were too great, and they kept her from imposing her will upon the soft blade. Moreover, sometimes the Xeno would attempt to interpret what she wanted, like an over-eager assistant, which usually resulted in it shooting out farther than she intended, but fortunately not with blades or spikes, and not so far as to endanger Sparrow, who nevertheless stayed as far away as the meager area would allow. For over an hour, the ex-Marine worked Kira over, testing her as thoroughly as Vishal and Carr had. But not just testing, training. She pushed Kira to explore the limits of the soft blade and of her interface with the alien organism, and when she found those limits, to strain against them until they widened. Throughout, Kira kept feeling the odd pains in her abdomen. They were starting to concern her. One thing Sparrow had her do that Kira hated, poke herself in the arm with the tip of a knife, and attempt, with each poke, to keep the soft blade from hardening in protection. As Sparrow said,
if you can't withstand a bit of discomfort for future gain, you're pretty much a waste of space.
So Kira kept stabbing her arm, biting her lip the whole while. It wasn't easy. The soft blade insisted upon squirming out of her mental grasp and stopping or diverting the descending blade.
Stop that,
she finally muttered, fed up. She stabbed again, only not at her arm, but at the soft blade, wishing she could cause it the same pain it had caused her.
Hey, watch it,
Sparrow said. Kira looked to see a spray of jagged thorns extending half a meter from her arm.
Ah, shit,
she exclaimed, retracting the thorns as fast as possible. Her expression grim, Sparrow scooted the bench back another few centimeters.
Not good, Navarez. Try again.
And Kira did. And it hurt. And it was hard. But she didn't give up. 2. Kira was sore, sweaty, and hungry by the time Sparrow called a halt to the proceedings. And she wasn't only tired in body, but in mind. Contending with the Xeno for so long was no easy matter. Nor had it been much of a success, which bothered her more than she liked to admit.
It was a start,
said Sparrow. You didn't have to push quite so hard, Kira said, wiping her face. You could have gotten hurt.
Someone already did get hurt, said Sparrow in a cutting tone. I'm just trying to keep it from happening again. Seems to me we pushed just hard enough.
Kira glared at her. You must have been real popular with your squad in the Marines.
Let me tell you what it was like. This one time in training, there was this dumb fuck from Stewart's World. Burke was his name. We were doing a stint on Earth. You ever visit Earth?
No. Sparrow half shrugged.
It's a crazy place. Beautiful, but there's living things wanting to kill you everywhere you go, just like Eidolon. Anyway, we were doing a manual fire drill. That means no implants or overlays to help. Burke was having a rough go of it, and then he finally gets in the groove and starts hitting his targets. Bam! His gun jams. He tried to clear the blockage, but nothing doing. Thing is, Burke had a temper like an overheated kettle. He's swearing and kicking, and he gets so worked up he throws his gun into the dirt.
Even I know better than that, said Kira.
Exactly. A rangemaster and 3 drill sergeants descend on Burke like the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. They chew him a new one, and then they have him pick up his rifle and march across the camp. Now, by the back of the dispensary, there was a hornet's nest. Ever been stung by a hornet?
Kira shook her head. She had lots of experience with bees on Wayland, but no hornets. They hadn't been cleared by the colony terraforming board. A faint smile curled Sparrow's lips.
Their little bullets of hate and fury. Hurt like a sumbitch, too. So Burke is ordered to stand underneath the hornet nest and poke it with his rifle. And then, while the hornets do their best to sting him to death, he had to clear the jam in his gun, strip it, give it a good field cleaning, and put it back together. And the whole time, one of the sergeants is standing nearby, covered head to toe in an exo, shouting at him, "Are you angry now?"
That seems rather extreme.
Better a bit of discomfort in training than a Marine who can't keep it together when bullets start flying.
Did it work? Kira asked. Sparrow got to her feet.
Sure did. Burke ended up being one of the finest.
Footsteps sounded.
and then Tatupoa poked his square-shaped head around the corner of one of the racks.
Everything all right with you? Got concerned with all the noises over here.
We're fine, thank you, said Sparrow.
Kira dabbed the last traces of sweat from her forehead and stood. Just exercising. Her stomach knotted again and she winced. The Marine stared at her skeptical.
You say so, ma'am.
3. Kira and Sparrow were quiet as they returned to the ship's central shaft. There, Sparrow rested for a moment on her crutch.
Same time again tomorrow, she said.
Kira opened her mouth and then clamped it shut. They would be jumping to FTL not long afterward. She could survive one more session with Sparrow, however difficult.
Fine, she said, but maybe play it a bit safer.
Sparrow pulled a stick of gum from her breast pocket, unwrapped it, and popped it in her mouth.
No deal. Terms are the same. You stab me, I shoot you. It's a nice simple arrangement, wouldn't you agree?
It was, but Kira wasn't going to admit it. How the hell did you survive this long without getting killed? Sparrow chuckled.
There's no such thing as safety. Only degrees of risk.
That's not an answer.
Then put it this way. I've had more practice than most dealing with risk.
There was an unspoken implication to her claim. Because I had to.
I think you just like the thrill.
Once more, a needle of pain shot through Kira's abdomen. Sparrow chuckled again.
Could be.
When they arrived at sickbay, Hua Chung was waiting for them outside. In one hand, she carried a small machine Kira didn't recognize.
Aish,
the machine boss said as Sparrow hobbled up.
You shouldn't walk around like this. It's not good for you.
She wrapped her free arm around Sparrow's shoulders and shepherded her into the room.
I'm fine,
Sparrow protested weakly, but it was obvious she was more exhausted than she was letting on. Inside, Vishal helped Hua Chung lift Sparrow onto the exam table, and there the small woman lay back and closed her eyes for a moment.
Here,
said Hua Chung, placing the machine on the short countertop next to the sink.
You need this.
What is it?
Said Sparrow, cracking open her eyes.
A humidifier. The air is too dry in here.
Vishal examined the machine with a degree of doubt.
The air here is the same as... Too dry,
Hua Chung insisted.
It is bad for her. It makes you sick. The humidity needs to be higher.
Sparrow smiled slightly.
You ain't gonna win this argument, Doc.
Vishal seemed as if he was going to protest for a moment, and then he raised his hands and backed off.
As you wish, Miss Song. It is not as if I work here.
Kira went over to him, and in a low voice said, Do you have a moment? The doctor bobbed his head.
For you, Ms. Navarez, of course. What seems to be the problem?
Kira glanced at the other two women, but they seemed busy talking with each other. Lowering her voice further, she said, My stomach has been hurting. I don't know if it's something I ate or... She trailed off, not wanting to give voice to the worst possibilities. Vishal's expression sharpened.
What did you have for breakfast?
I haven't eaten yet.
Ah, very well. Please stand over here, Miss Navarez, and I will see what I can do.
Kira stood in a corner of the sickbay, feeling slightly embarrassed to have Sparrow and Hua Chung watching while the doctor listened to her chest with a stethoscope and then pressed against her belly with his hands.
Does it hurt here?
He asked, touching just below her ribcage.
No.
His hands moved a few centimeters lower.
Here.
She shook her head. His hands moved lower still.
Here.
The sharp intake of her breath was answer enough.
Yeah,
she said, her voice tight with pain. A furrow appeared between Vishal's brows.
1 minute, Ms. Navarez.
He pulled open a nearby drawer and rummaged through it. Call me Kira, please.
Ah, yes. Of course, Miss Kira.
No, I mean... Never mind. Across the room, Sparrow popped her gum.
You'll never get him to unbend. The doc here is as stiff as a rod of titanium.
Vishal muttered something in the language Kira didn't understand. And then he returned to her with an odd-looking device.
Please lay on the floor and unseal your jumpsuit. Not all the way. Halfway will do.
The deck was rough against her back. She held still while he spread a cold goo across her lower stomach. A sonogram, then. The doctor chewed on the inside of his lip while he studied the feed from the sonogram on his overlays. Kira expected an answer of some kind when Vishal finished, but instead he held up a finger and said,
"It is needful to do a blood test, Miss Kira. Would you please remove the soft blade from your arm?"
That's not good. Again, Kira followed his orders, trying to ignore the worm of unease turning in her gut. Or maybe it was just the pain from whatever was wrong inside her. A sharp prick as the needle broke her unprotected skin. Then silence for a few minutes as they waited for the sick bay's computers to run the diagnostics.
"Ah, here we are,"
said the doctor, and started reading his overlays, eyes darting from side to side. Sparrow said,
"Well, what is it, Doc?"
"If Miss Kira chooses to tell you, that is her choice," said Vishal. "However, she is still my patient and I am still her physician, and as such this is privileged information."
He gestured toward the door and said to Kira, "After you, my dear."
"Yeah, yeah," said Sparrow,
but there was no concealing the spark of curiosity in her eyes. Once out in the hallway, with the door closed behind them, Kira said, "How bad is it?"
"It's not bad at all, Miss Kira," said Vishal. "You are menstruating. What you are feeling are uterine cramps. Quite normal."
"I'm..."
For a moment, Kira was at a loss.
"That can't be possible.
I had my periods turned off when I first hit puberty, and the only time she'd reactivated them had been in college, during the stupidest 6 months of her life, with him." A flush of unwelcome memories crowded her mind. Vishal spread his hands.
"I am sure you are right, Miss Kira, but the results are unmistakable. You are most certainly menstruating. There is no doubt whatsoever."
"That shouldn't be possible."
"No, it shouldn't."
Kira put her fingers to her temples. A dull ache was forming behind her eyes. The Xeno must have thought I was injured somehow, so it repaired me. She walked back and forth across the corridor, and then stopped, hands on her hips.
"Shit. So am I going to have to deal with this from now on? Can't you do something to turn them back off?"
Vishal hesitated, and then made a helpless motion.
"If the suit will heal you, then nothing I can do would stop it. Unless I remove your ovaries and..."
"There's no way the soft blade would let you."
"Yeah."
The doctor glanced at his overlays.
"There are hormonal treatments we could try, but I must warn you, Ms. Navarez, they can have some undesirable side effects. Also, I can't guarantee their efficacy, as the Xeno might interfere with absorption and metabolism."
"Okay, okay."
Kira paced the breadth of the corridor again.
"Fine. Leave it. If I feel any worse, maybe we can try the pills."
The doctor nodded.
"As you wish."
He drew a long finger across his bottom lip and then said,
One point to remember, Miss Navarez, and I apologize most seriously for mentioning it. Practically, there is no reason you could not become pregnant now. However, as your physician, I have to..."
"I'm not getting pregnant,"
Kira said, harsher than she intended. She laughed, but there was no humor in the sound. "Besides, I don't think the soft blade would allow it, even if I wanted."
"Exactly, Miss Kira. I could not guarantee your safety, nor the safety of the fetus."
"Understood. I appreciate your concern." She scuffed her heel against the deck, thinking. "You don't have to report this to anyone on the Darmstadt, do you?" Vishal twisted a hand in the air.
"They wish me to, but I would not betray the confidentiality of a patient."
"Thank you."
"Of course, Miss Kira. Would you like me to fix your nose for you now? Otherwise, it will have to wait until tomorrow. I will be busy with Sparrow later."
"She told me. Tomorrow."
"As you wish."
He returned to the sick bay, leaving her alone in the corridor. 4.
Pregnant.
Kira's stomach twisted, and not from the cramps. After what had happened in college, she'd sworn she would never have children. It had taken meeting Alan to make her reconsider, and only because she liked him so much. Now, though, the thought filled her with revulsion. What sort of hybrid monstrosity would the Xeno produce if she got pregnant? She reached up to fiddle with a lock of hair. Her fingers scraped scalp. Well, it wasn't like she was going to get pregnant by accident. All she had to do was avoid sleeping with anyone. Not so difficult. For a moment, her thoughts detoured into mechanical details. Would sex even be possible? If she had the soft blade retract from between her legs, then it might work. But whomever she was with would have to be brave. Very brave. And if she lost her hold on the suit and it closed shut,
Ouch. She glanced down at herself. At least she didn't have to worry about bleeding. The soft blade was as efficient as always in recycling her body's waste. The door to the sick bay opened as Hua Chong exited.
Do you have a moment? Said Kira. Could you help me?
The machine boss stared at her.
What?
From anyone else, the question would have sounded rude. But from Hua Chong, Kira thought it was just a simple request. Kira explained what she needed and what she wanted. They weren't the same things.
This way,
said Hua Chong, and lumbered off toward the core of the ship. As they started down the central ladder, Kira eyed the machine boss, curious. How did you end up on the Wallfish, if you don't mind me asking?
Captain Falcone needed a machine boss. I needed a job. Now I work here.
Do you have family back on Xinzhar? The top of Hua Chong's head moved as she nodded.
Many brothers and sisters. Many cousins. I send them money when I can.
Why did you leave?
Because,
said Hua Chong as she stepped off the ladder on the deck just above the cargo holds. She lifted her hands, fingers bunched, the tips pressed together.
Boom.
And she opened her hands, splaying her fingers. Ah. Kira couldn't decide if the machine boss was being literal or not, and she decided it was better not to ask. Do you ever visit?
Once. No more.
Leaving the shaft, they passed through a narrow passageway and entered a room close to the hull. It was a machine shop, small and cramped, stuffed with more pieces of equipment than Kira recognized, but impeccably organized. The scent of solvent stung her nose, and the smell of ozone put a bitter, nickel-like taste on her tongue.
Warning. Some chemicals are known by the League of Allied Worlds to cause cancer, said Hua Chong,
as she edged sideways between the different machines.
That's easy enough to treat, said Kira.
Hua Chong chuckled.
They still require the disclaimers, bureaucrats.
She stopped by a wall of drawers at the back of the shop and slapped them.
Here. Powdered metals, polycarbonates, organic substrates, carbon fiber, more. All the raw stock you could need.
Is there anything I shouldn't take?
Organics. Metals are easy to replace. Organics are harder, more expensive.
Okay, I'll avoid them.
Hua Chong shrugged. You can take some. Just not too much. Whatever you do. Do not cross-contaminate with any of these. It will ruin whatever we make with them.
Gotcha. I won't. Then she showed Kira how to unlock the drawers and open the storage packs inside.
You understand now, yes? I will go and see if I can print what you want.
Thank you. As Hua Chong left, Kira dipped her fingers into a mound of powdered aluminum, while at the same time telling the Xeno, eat. If it did, she couldn't tell. She sealed the pack, closed the drawer, cleaned her hand with a wet wipe from the dispenser on the wall, and, once her skin was dry, tried the same thing with the powdered titanium. Drawer by drawer, she worked her way through the ship's supplies. The suit seemed to absorb little to none of the metals. It had apparently sated most of its hunger during the night. However, it displayed a distinct preference for some of the rarer elements, such as samarium, neodymium, and yttrium, among others. Cobalt and zinc, too. To her surprise, it ignored all the biological compounds. When Kira was finished, she left the machine shop with Hua Chong still there working, bent over the control display for the ship's main printer, and returned to the galley. Kira fixed herself a late breakfast, which she ate at a leisurely pace. It was nearly noon, and she was already wiped from the day's events. Sparrow's training, if it could be called that, had taken a serious toll. Her abdomen twinged again, and she grimaced. Wonderful. Just wonderful. She looked up as Nielsen walked in. The first officer got herself some food from the fridge, and then sat opposite Kira. They ate in silence for a time. Then Nielsen said,
"You've set us on a strange path, Nevarez."
"Eat the path." "Can't argue with you there. Does it bother you?" The woman set down her fork. "I'm not happy that we'll be gone for over 6 months, if that's what you're asking. The League is going to be in serious trouble by the time we get back, unless through some miracle these attacks let off. But we might be able to help if we find the Staff of Blue. Yes, I'm aware of the rationale. Nielsen took a sip of water. When I joined the Wallfish, I didn't think I was signing up for combat, chasing alien relics or expeditions into the unexplored regions of the galaxy. And yet, here we are. Kira tipped her head. Yeah, I wasn't looking for any of this either, aside from the exploration. And the alien relics. A smile forced its way onto Kira's face. And that. Nielsen smiled slightly also. Then she surprised her by saying, I heard Sparrow put you through the ringer this morning. How are you holding up? Simple as it was, the question softened Kira. Okay. But it was a lot. It's all a lot. I can imagine. Kira made a face. Plus, now, she half laughed. You're not going to believe it, but... And she told Nielsen about the return of her periods. The first officer made a sympathetic face. How inconvenient. At least you don't have to worry about bleeding. No, small favors, huh? Kira raised her glass in a mock toast, and Nielsen did the same. Then the first officer said, Listen, Kira, if you need someone to talk with, someone other than Grigorovich, come find me. My door is always open. Kira studied her for a long moment, gratitude welling up inside her. Then she nodded. I'll keep that in mind. Thank you. 5. Kira spent the rest of the day helping around the ship. A lot still needed doing before they went FTL. Lines and filters to check, diagnostics to run, general cleaning, and so on. Kira didn't mind the work. It made her feel useful, and it kept her from thinking too much. She even helped Trig fix the damaged bed in her cabin, which she was grateful to have done, knowing as she did that, if all went well, she would be spending months there on the mattress, lost in the death-like sleep of the soft blades-induced hibernation. The thought frightened her, so she worked harder and tried not to dwell on it. When ship evening came, everyone but the Marines gathered in the galley, even Sparrow. I thought you had surgery, said Falcone, glowering at her from under his thick eyebrows.
I put it off till later, she said.
They all knew why she wanted to be there. Dinner was their last chance to spend time together as a group before going into FTL.
That's safe, Doc,
Falcone asked. Bishal nodded.
As long as she does not eat any solid food, she will be fine.
Sparrow smirked.
Good thing then you were the one cooking tonight, Doc. Makes it easy to wait.
A shadow flitted across Vishal's face, but he didn't argue. I'm glad you are safe for your surgery, miss, was all he said. A text popped up on Kira's overlays. Sparrow told me about your session together. Sounds like she worked you over pretty good, Falcone.
That about sums it up. She's intense, but thorough.
Very thorough. Kira. Good. Falcone. How did she think it went? Kira. She said she served with worse trainees in boot. Falcone.
Thanks. I guess.
Kira. He chuckled quietly.
Trust me. Coming from her, it's a compliment. Falcone.
The mood around the room was lighter than the previous day, although there was an underlying tension that gave their conversations a manic edge. None of them wanted to discuss what was about to come, but it hung over them like an unspoken threat. The conversation loosened until Kira felt bold enough to say,
Okay, I know this is rude, but there's a question I have to ask.
No, you don't, said Falcone, sipping from his glass of wine. She plowed onward as if he hadn't said anything.
Akawe mentioned you wanted pardons before you'd agreed to go.
What for? Around the room, the crew shifted uneasily, while the entropists looked on with interest.
Trig, you mentioned some difficulties at Ruslan, so I was just wondering.
Kira leaned back and waited to see what would happen. Falcone scowled at his glass. You can't help sticking your nose where it doesn't belong, can you? In a somewhat placating tone, Nielsen said,
We should tell her. There's no reason to keep it a secret, not now. Fine. You tell her then.
How bad was it? Kira wondered. Smuggling? Theft? Assault? Murder?
Nielsen sighed, and then, as if she guessed what Kira was thinking, said, It's not what you imagine. I wasn't on the ship at the time, but the crew ended up in trouble because they imported a whole bunch of newts to sell on Ruslan. For a moment, Kira wasn't sure she'd heard right.
Newts?
Yeah, a metric newt ton of them, said Trig. Sparrow laughed and then grimaced and clutched her side.
Don't, said Nielsen, just don't.
Trig grinned and dug back into his food.
There was a children's show on Ruslan, said Falcone. Yanni the Newt, or something like that. It was really popular.
Was? He made a face.
All the kids wanted newts as pets, so it seemed like a good idea to bring in a shipload of them.
Nielsen rolled her eyes and shook her head, which sent her ponytail flying. If I'd been on the Wolfish, I wouldn't have allowed such nonsense. Falcone took issue with that.
It was a good job. You would have jumped at the opportunity faster than any of us.
Why not just grow the newts in a lab? Asked Kira, puzzled. Or gene hack something like a frog to look like them.
They did, he said. But the rich kids wanted real newts from Earth. You know how it is.
Kira blinked. That could not have been cheap. Falcone dipped his head with a sardonic smile.
Exactamento. We would have made a fortune, only...
The damn things didn't have a kill switch, said Sparrow.
They didn't, Kira started to say, and then stopped herself. Of course, because they were from Earth. All macroorganisms and more than a few micro grown on colonized worlds had built-in genetic kill switches to make it easy to manage their population and keep any one organism from disrupting the nascent food chain or, if present, the native ecology. But not on Earth. There, plants and animals just existed, mixing and competing in a chaotic mess that still defied attempts at control. Falcone extended a hand toward her.
Yep. We found a company that breeds newts.
Think Noddle's Pious Newt Emporium,
Trig helpfully supplied.
But we didn't exactly tell them where the newts were going. No reason for the ITC to know what we were up to now, was there?
We didn't even think about a kill switch, said Sparrow. And by the time we sold them, it was too late to fix.
How many did you sell?
777,777.
76, said Sparrow. Don't forget the one Mr. Fuzzy Pants ate.
Right, 76, said Trig.
Kira had difficulty even imagining that many newts. Falcone continued the tale.
As you'd expect, a bunch of the newts escaped, and without any natural predators, they wiped out a good chunk of Ruslan's insects, worms, snails, etc.
Good God! Without insects and the like, it was pretty much impossible for a colony to function. Worms alone were worth more than their weight in refined uranium during the early years of transforming sterile or hostile land into fertile soil.
It was like a neutron bomb, said Trig.
Sparrow and Nielsen groaned, and Vishal said,
That was the sort of pun we had to endure for the whole trip, Miss Kira. It was most unpleasant.
Kira fixed Trig with a look.
Hey, what do you call a really smart newt?
He grinned.
What?
Newton, of course.
Permission to jettison both of them as punishment, Captain, said Nielsen.
Granted, Falcone said, but not until we reach our destination.
At that, the mood in the galley grew more somber. So what happened after with the newts? Kira asked. The punishment for violating biocontainment protocols varied from place to place, but it usually involved heavy fines and or jail time.
Falcone grunted. What do you think? The local government issued warrants for our arrest. Fortunately, they were only planetary warrants, not stellar or interstellar, and we were gone long before the newts started to cause a problem. But yeah, they were not too happy with us. They even ended up canceling Yanni the Newt because so many people were pissed off.
Kira chuckled, and then she burst out into a full laugh.
Sorry, I know it's not funny, but...
Well, it is a little funny, said Vishal.
Here,
Goddamned hilarious, said Falcone. To Kira, they retroactively nulled the bits we earned, which left us out food, fuel, and propellant for the whole trip. I can see how that might have left you feeling neutered, she said.
Thul, now we have two of them.
Gimme that, said Falcone, and reached for his holstered pistol, which was slung over the back of Vishal's seat. The doctor laughed and shook his head.
Not a chance, Captain.
Gah! Mutineers, the lot of you.
Don't you mean newtoneers? Said Trig.
That's it! Enough with the punning, or I'll have you thrown into cryo right now!
Sure!
To Kira, Nielsen said,
we had a few other smaller difficulties, mainly ITC violations, but that was the main one.
Sparrow snorted.
That and Chellamy.
In response to Kira's inquiring look, she said,
we got hired by a guy named Griffith back at Alpha Centauri to bring in a load of, sensitive cargo for a guy on Chellamy Station, only our contact wasn't there when we dropped off the goods. The idiot got himself arrested by station security, so the station wanted our asses as well. Griffith claims we failed delivery and won't pay, and since we used up the last of our antimatter getting here, there wasn't anything we could do about it.
And that, said Falcone, emptying his glass, is how we ended up stranded at 61 Cygni. Couldn't land back at Chellamy, and couldn't land on Ruslan. Legally, that is.
Gotcha. Overall, it wasn't as bad as Kira had feared. A bit of smuggling, a small amount of what might be classified as eco-terrorism. Really, she'd expected far worse. Falcone waved his hand. That's all cleared up now, though. He peered at her, his eyes slightly bleary from drink. I suppose we have you to thank for that.
My pleasure.
Later, once most of the food was cleared off the tables, Hua Chong left her seat by Sparrow and vanished out the door. When the machine boss returned, she brought with her Runcible and Mr. Fuzzy Pants, but also, tucked under one arm, the other thing Kira had asked her for.
Here, said Hua Chong, and held out the concertina to Kira. It just finished printing.
Kira laughed and took the instrument. Thank you. Now she would have something to do other than stare at her overlays while she waited alone in the empty ship. Falcone raised an eyebrow.
You play?
A little, said Kira, slipping her hands through the straps and testing the keys. Then she performed a simple little arrangement called Chiara's Folly as a warm-up. The music brought a sense of cheer to the room, and the crew gathered in close.
Hey, you know toxopaxia?
Sparrow asked.
I do.
Kira played until her fingers were numb, but she didn't mind, and for a time, no thoughts of the future intruded, and life was good. Mr. Fuzzypants still kept his distance from her, but at some point deep in the evening, long after she'd put aside the concertina, Kira found herself with Runcible's warm weight in her lap while she scratched behind the pig's ears and he wiggled his tail in delight. A surge of affection passed through Kira, and for the first time since the deaths of Alan and her other teammates, she felt herself relaxing, truly relaxing. So maybe Falcone was a hard-edged bastard, and their ship mind was eccentric, and Sparrow was somewhat of a sadist, and Trig was still just a kid, and Hua Chong was weird in her own ways. And Vishal, Kira wasn't sure what the deal was with Vishal, but he seemed nice enough. So maybe all that. So what? Nothing was ever perfect. Kira knew one thing for certain, though. She'd fight for Falcone and his crew. She'd fight for them the same as she would have fought for her team on Adra. 6. As a group, they ended up staying in the galley far later than they should have, but no one complained, least of all Kira. The evening ended with her showing, at the entropist's request, how the soft blade could form different shapes on its surface. She made a smiley face rise out of her palm, and Falcone said, talk to the hand. Everyone laughed. At some point, Sparrow, Vishal, and Hua Chung departed for sickbay. Without them, the galley was noticeably quieter. Sparrow's surgery was going to take some time. Long before it finished, Kira returned to her cabin, fell onto her new mattress, and slept. And for once, she didn't dream. 7. Morning arrived, and with it, a sense of dread.
The jump to FTL was only a few hours away. Kira lay where she was for a while and tried to reconcile herself with what was to come. I brought this on myself. The thought made her feel better than believing she was a victim of circumstances. But it still didn't make her feel great. She roused herself and checked her overlays. No news of significance, aside from reports of minor fighting on Ruslan. And no texts. Also no cramps. That was a relief. She messaged Sparrow. Do you still want to do this? Kira. After a minute.
Yes. In sick bay. Sparrow.
Kira washed her face, dressed, and headed out. When the door to sickbay opened, she was shocked by how weak Sparrow looked. The woman's face was drawn and pale, and she had an IV pinned in her arm. Somewhat taken aback, Kira said, Are you going to be able to handle cryo?
I'm looking forward to it, Sparrow said dryly. Doc seems to think I'll do just fine. Might even help me heal better, long term.
Are you really up for more whatever the hell this is? Sparrow produced a crooked smile.
Oh, yeah. I've thought of a whole bunch of different ways to test your patience.
She proved true to her word. Back to the makeshift gym they went, and again she put Kira through a rigorous series of exercises, while Kira struggled to retain control over the soft blade. Sparrow didn't make it easy. The woman had a talent for distraction, and she indulged in it, harassing Kira with words, sounds, and unexpected movements during the most difficult parts of the exercises. And Kira failed. Again and again she failed, and she grew increasingly frustrated with her inability to maintain her mental footing. With so much input, it was almost inevitable that her concentration would slip. And where it slipped, the soft blade took over, choosing of its own judgment how best to act. The organism's decisions built a sense of character, one that was impulsive and eager to find flaws that could be exploited. Its was a questing consciousness full of unbridled curiosity, despite its oftentimes destructive nature. So it went. Sparrow continued to harass her, and Kira continued to try to retain her composure. After an hour, her face was drenched with sweat, and she felt nearly as exhausted as Sparrow looked. How'd I do? She asked, getting up from the deck.
Don't go watch a scary movie, that's all I have to say, said Sparrow.
Ah.
What? You want cookies and compliments? You didn't give up. Keep not giving up and you might impress me someday.
Sparrow lay back on the bench and closed her eyes.
It's on you now. You know what you need to do while we're corpsicles.
I have to keep practicing.
And you can't make it easy on yourself.
I won't. Sparrow cracked open an eye. She smiled.
You know what, Navarez? I believe you.
The hours that followed were a frenzy of preparation. Kira helped Vishal sedate the ship pets, and then both Runcible and Mr. Fuzzypants were placed inside a cryo tube just big enough to hold the both of them. Shortly thereafter, the thrust alert sounded, and the Wallfish cut its engines so it could cool down as much as possible before hitting the Markov limit. Nearby, the Darmstadt did the same, the cruiser's diamond radiators glittering in the dim light from the system's star. One by one, the Wallfish's systems were shut down, and the inside of the ship became progressively cooler and darker. The four Marines in the porthold were the first to enter cryo. They gave their notice, and then their systems vanished from the ship, intranet, as they lapsed into death-like stasis. Next were the entropists. Their cryotubes were in their cabin. We're off to lay ourselves in our hibernacula. Travel safely, prisoners, they said, before sequestering themselves. Kira and the crew of the Wallfish gathered in the ship's storm shelter, right near the center of the ship. Just below control, and adjacent to the sealed room that contained the armored sarcophagus Grigorovich called home. Kira hung by the door of the shelter, feeling helpless as Sparrow, Huachong, Trig, Vishal, and Nielsen stripped into their underwear and got into their tubes. The lids closed, and within seconds the interiors fogged over. Falcone waited until the last.
You gonna be okay on your own?
He asked, pulling his shirt over his head. Kira averted her gaze. I think so. Once Grigorovich goes under, our pseudo-intelligence Morvan will be in charge of navigation and life support. But if something goes wrong, don't hesitate to wake one of us up. Okay. He unlaced his boots, stuck them in a locker. Seriously. Even if you just need to talk to another person. We're gonna have to drop out of FTL a few times anyway. If I need to, I promise I will. She glanced over to see Falcone in just his skivvies. He was more heavily built than she'd realized. Thick chest, thick arms, thick back. Sparrow and Hua Chong obviously weren't the only ones who used the weights in the hold. Good. Then he pulled himself along the wall and floated over to her. Up close, Kira could smell the sweat on him. A clean, healthy musk. A mat of thick black hair covered his chest, and for a moment, just a moment, she imagined running her fingers through it. Falcone noticed her gaze and met it with an even more direct look. He said, "One other thing. Since you're the only person who's going to be up and around, not much if I can help it, you'll still be more functional than any of us. Since that's the case, I'm naming you acting captain of the Wallfish while we're in cryo." Kira was surprised. She started to say something, thought better of it, and then tried again.
"Are you sure? Even after what happened?"
"I'm sure," said Falcone firmly.
"Does that mean I'm part of the crew then?"
"I suppose it does. For the duration of the trip, at least." She considered the idea.
"What sort of responsibilities does an acting captain have?"
"Quite a few," he said, going over to his cryotube. "It gives you executive access to certain systems. Override ability, too. Might be needed in an emergency."
"Thank you. Appreciate it."
He nodded. "Just don't wreck my ship, Navarez. She's all I've got."
"Not all," said Kira, and gestured at the frozen tubes. A faint smile appeared on Falcone's face.
"No, not all."
She watched as he lowered himself into the tube, hooked up the drip to his arm, and attached the electrodes to his head and chest. He looked at her once more and gave her a small salute.
"See you by the light of a strange star, Captain."
"Captain?"
Then the lid closed over Falcone's face, and silence settled over the shelter.
"Just you and me now, Headcase," said Kira, looking in the direction of Grigorovich's sarcophagus.
"That too shall pass," said the ship mind.
8. 14 minutes later, the Wallfish went FTL. Kira watched the transition on the display in her cabin. One moment, a field of stars surrounded them. The next, a dark mirror, perfectly spherical. She studied the ship's reflection for a long, wordless while, and then closed the display and wrapped her arms around herself. They were finally on their way. Exeunt 2. 1. Outside the Wallfish, the Darmstadt was flying along a parallel course, swaddled in its own protective soap bubble of energy. Communication between ships and FTL was possible, but difficult. The data rate was slow and lossy, and since they didn't want to attract the attention of the jellies or anyone else who might be listening, the only signals passing between them were an occasional ping to check the ship's relative positions. Inside the Wallfish, it was as quiet as Kira had feared. She drifted along the dark corridors, feeling more like a ghost than a person. Grigorovich was still awake and talking, a whispering presence that filled the hull, but was poor substitute for face-to-face interaction with another person. Nevertheless, a poor substitute was better than nothing, and Kira was grateful for the company, strange as it was. The ship mind needed to enter cryo himself. His oversized brain produced more heat than most people's entire bodies. However, as he said,
"I shall wait with you, O Tentacle Queen, until you sleep, and then I too shall sink into oblivion."
"We're both bounded in a nutshell right now, aren't we?"
"Indeed."
And his lingering sigh dwindled through the ship. A sigil appeared on a display next to her. It was the first time she'd seen the ship mind represent himself with any sort of avatar. She studied the symbol for a moment, her overlays couldn't identify it, and said,
"Since you're still up, shouldn't you be the acting captain of the Wallfish?"
A chuckle like burbling water surrounded her.
"The ship mind cannot be captain, foolish meatbag, and a captain cannot be a ship mind. You know that."
It's just tradition, said Kira. There's no good reason why—
There are most comely and toothsome reasons. For safety and sanity, no shipmind should be master of their own ship, even if the ship is become our flesh.
That seems like it would be terribly frustrating. Kira could almost hear Grigorovich's shrug.
There is no reason in railing against reality. Besides my charming infestation, while the letter of the law may say one thing, the execution of the law is often quite different.
Meaning?
In practice, most ships are run by shipmines. How else could it be?
She caught a handhold by her cabin door, stopping herself. What's the name of the Darmstadt's mine?
She is the most crisp and delightful Horstja Ubuto.
That's quite a mouthful.
With no tongue to taste and no throat to sing, all names are equal.
2. In her cabin, Kira dimmed the lights and lowered the temperature. The time had come for winding down of mind and body. She would hibernate as soon as the soft blade would allow, but hibernation wasn't her only concern. She also needed to practice with the Zeno. Sparrow was right. Falcone was right. She had to master the soft blade as much as it could be mastered. And as with all skills, doing so would require diligence. Over the course of the next 3 months, the wallfish would drop out of FTL on at least 6 occasions to dump its excess heat. Each time would be an opportunity for her to push herself physically, as she had with Sparrow. In between, Kira would have to minimize her activity. But she still planned on waking once per week to work with the soft blade. That would give her a total of 12 practice sessions before they arrived at their destination. Enough, she hoped, to make meaningful progress. Whether or not the soft blade could pull her in and out of hibernation each week wasn't something Kira was sure of, but it was worth a try. If the Zeno couldn't, she'd have to eliminate some of the training. Regardless of the heat she produced and the resources she consumed, it was crucial to minimize the amount of time she spent awake and alone. True isolation could cause serious psychological damage in a surprisingly short span. It was a problem for any small crew on a long-haul mission, and being entirely by herself would only exacerbate the problem. Either way, she'd have to keep close tabs on her mental health. At least on this trip, she didn't have to worry about starving to death. There was plenty of food on the wallfish. Still, she didn't plan on eating much, only when exercising during their breaks in FTL. Besides, hunger seemed to be one of the triggers that helped convince the soft blade to place her into stasis. Eat the path. Eat the path. Having decided on a course of action, Kira set her weekly alarm and then spent the next hour contending with the soft blade in the first of their sessions. Since she wasn't using exercise to induce physical or mental stress this time, Kira found another, equally challenging test for herself, attempting to solve mental problems while coaxing the Zeno into making different shapes. Mathematical equations proved to be an excellent stressor in that regard. She also imagined being back on the jelly ship, with tentacles wrapped around her, unable to move, or the jolt of pain from the numinist breaking her nose, and she let the memory of fear quicken her pulse, flood her veins with adrenaline. And then Kira did her best to shape the soft blade as she saw fit. The second way wasn't the healthiest choice. She was just training her endocrine system to overreact to physical danger. But she needed to be able to work with the soft blade under less than ideal circumstances, and right then, she didn't have many options. When she no longer had the mental focus to keep practicing, Kira relaxed by playing her new concertina. It had pearl-like buttons and a swirling inlay along the sides of the box. The design had been an addition of Hua Chung's, and Kira appreciated it. When not playing, she traced the swirls with her fingers and admired how the faint emergency lights reflected red. Grigorovich listened to her music. He had become a constant, unseen companion. Sometimes he offered commentary, a piece of praise or a suggestion, but mostly he seemed content to be her respectful audience. First one day, then two crept by. Time seemed to slow. A familiar telescoping that left Kira feeling trapped in a shapeless limbo. Her thoughts grew slow and clumsy, and her fingers no longer found the right buttons on the concertina. She put the instrument aside then, and again turned on Bach's concertos,
and allowed the music to sweep her away. Grigorovich's voice roused her from a state of torpor. The ship mind was speaking soft and slow.
Kira. Kira. Are you awake?
What is it? She murmured.
I have to leave you now.
All right.
Are you going to be okay, Kira?
Yes, I'm good.
Okay. Good night then, Kira. Dream of beautiful things.
3. Kira lay on her bed, attached to it by the soft blade. There were straps mounted along the side for sleeping in zero-G. She had used them at first, but when she realized the Xeno could hold her in place without constant supervision, she undid them. As she drifted ever deeper into the hazy twilight of near unconsciousness, she allowed the mask to slide into place over her face, and she was dimly aware of the suit bonding with itself, joining limb to limb and winding her in a protective shell, black as ink and hard as a diamond. She could have stopped it, but she liked the feeling. Sleep. She urged the soft blade to rest and wait as it had once before, to enter dormancy and no longer strive. The Xeno was slow to understand, but in time, the pangs of hunger eased, and a familiar chill crept through her limbs. Then the strains of Bach faded from awareness, and the universe constricted to the confines of her mind. When she dreamed, her dreams were troubled, full of anger and dread and malignant forms lurking in the shadows. An enormous room of gray and gold, with ranks of windows revealing the dark of space beyond. Stars glimmered in the depths, and by their dim light there gleamed the polished floor and pillars of fluted metal. Flesh that she was could see nothing among the hidden corners of the chamber that seemed to have no end, but she felt the eyes of unknown, unfriendly intelligences watching, watching with unsated hunger. Shards of fear affixed her, and no relief had she of action, for the covetous observers remained hidden, though she could feel them creeping closer. And the shadows twisted and churned with incomprehensible shapes. Flashes of images, an invisible box filled with a broken promise that thrashed with mindless rage, a planet blanketed in black, and pregnant with malevolent intelligence. Streamers of fire descending through an evening sky. Beautiful and terrifying. And heartbreakingly sad to see. Towers toppled. Blood boiling in a vacuum. The crust of earth shuddering. Splitting. Spilling lava across a fertile plain. And worse still. Things unseen. Fears that had no name. Ancient. An alien, nightmares that revealed themselves only in a sense of wrongness and a twisting of fixed angles. 4.
Boop-a-beep, boop-a-beep, boop-a-beep.
The ratcheting alarm hauled Kira back to wakefulness. She blinked, confused and bleary, for a long moment not understanding. Then a sense of self and place returned to her, and she groaned.
Computer, stop alarm. She whispered.
Her voice sounded clearly even through the material that covered her face. The jarring bleat fell silent. For a handful of minutes, she lay in the dark and the silence, unable to bring herself to move.
1 week.
It felt longer, as if she'd been anchored to the bed for an eternity, and yet at the same time as if she'd just closed her eyes. The cabin was stifling, oppressive, like a chamber deep underground. Her heart quickened.
All right, come on you, she said to the soft blade.
Kira willed the mask off her face and freed her limbs from the web of fibers that bound them to her torso. Then she worked hard with the Xeno, straining with and against it. When she finally stopped, her stomach was grinding and she was fully awake, even though she'd left the lights off. She drank a few sips of water and again attempted to sleep. It took longer than she wanted, half a day at least. But in time, her mind and body relaxed, and she sank back into welcome latency. And when she slept, she moaned and fretted in the torment of her dreams. And nothing there was to break the spell as the wallfish hurtled ever deeper into unknown space. 5. Thereafter, things grew hazy and disjointed. The empty sameness of her surroundings, coupled with the strangeness of the Xeno-induced hibernation, left Kira disoriented. She felt detached from events, as if all were a dream and she a disembodied spirit observing. Yet in one particular, she felt very bodied. And that was her time practicing with the soft blade. Seemingly endless practice. Were there changes in her ability to control the Xeno? Were there improvements? Kira wasn't sure, but she persisted. If nothing else, an innate stubbornness wouldn't let her give up. She had faith in the value of work. If she just kept putting in the effort, it had to do some good. The thought was her only consolation when something went wrong with the soft blade. Failure came in many forms. The Xeno refused to move as she wished. Or it overreacted. Those were the slip-ups that most concerned Kira. Or it obeyed, but in generalities, not specifics. She might will it to form a rose-like pattern on her hand, only for it to produce a round, lumpy dome. It was hard, frustrating labor, but Kira stuck to it. And though at times the soft blade seemed frustrated also, as she could tell by the lag in its responses or by the types of shapes it formed, she felt a willingness to cooperate from the Xeno, and it encouraged her. During the times the wallfish dropped out of FTL, she allowed herself to leave her cabin, wander the ship, have a cup of chal in the galley, run on the zero-G treadmill and do all the exercises she could with bands and straps. They weren't enough to maintain muscle or bone, for that she relied upon the Xeno, but they were a welcome break in the monotony of her weekly practice. Then the ship's systems would again power down, the jump alert would sound, and she would retreat back to her darkened cave. 6. A month had passed. A month, and sometimes Kira was convinced she was stuck in a never-ending loop. Close her eyes, wake, free her limbs, practice. Close her eyes, wake, free her limbs, practice. It was getting to her. She seriously debated waking Grigorovich or Falcone or Nielsen to have someone to talk with. But waking them would be a huge inconvenience for only a few hours of conversation, if that. It might even delay the expedition depending on how much heat they generated. No matter how strange or lonely she felt, Kira wasn't willing to risk that. Finding the staff of Blue was more important than her desire for human company. 7. 2 months. Nearly there. That was what she told herself. She celebrated with a ration bar and a cup of hot chocolate. The training with the soft blade was getting easier. Or maybe that was just what she wanted to believe. She could hold and shape the Xeno in ways that had escaped her before. That was progress, wasn't it? Kira thought so. But she felt so detached from anything tangible that she didn't trust her own judgment. Not so long now. Not so long.